with liberty and justice for all.
Next is a public comment period, and I'd like to announce that speaker slips are back in the door where you come in. Staff reports are over here on your right by the stairs, and this public comment period is to speak about anything other than what's on the agenda. Is there anyone wishing to do that? Seeing none, then I'll move on to the next item, the consent agenda. Is there anyone wishing from the public wishing to speak on the consent agenda? Oh, I'm sorry, I missed planning staff updates. Let's back up here a little bit.
I just thought you wanted to get a head start.
Well, yeah, right. Go ahead, Warren, it's your time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Warren Hogue, Department of Planning and Building. I'd just like to catch up on a few things that happened at a recent board meeting since your last Planning Commission meeting. On June 13th, the board chose not to move forward at this time with the alternative ordinance by Pauper for the Adelaide Visual Standards. They instead have continued and asked for staff to do more outreach and research on that. They did act on some appeals of SRB decisions to uphold those appeals. They also elected to put the Delidio Marketplace item on the initiative on the ballot without additional formal study. And they denied an appeal on certificates of compliance. So that was on June 13th. And then on June 20th, actually, on June 19th, as part of their two-day budget hearings, they did adopt the department budget as recommended by the County Administrative Office, and some of the highlights on that is funding for the Phase 1 of the Conservation Element Update, which we've discussed with your commission a couple times recently. Also, some funding to continue updates for Shannon Community Plan. Continued implementation of the smart growth principles, continued participation with Public Works on infrastructure planning to determine how to finance needed community improvements. There were three staff positions added, an administrative assistant to deal with the new personnel management and accounting system, a planner for affordable housing implementation, and an environmental resource specialist to help manage the growing volume of to try to answer them fully now, but I'll try to give you the simplest answer I can to try to stay out of trouble. If the initiative is approved and not subsequently challenged in court, then that means that the general plan and zoning has been changed for the project and that a site-specific zoning ordinance is adopted for the project, which would in effect make what's proposed is to make the subsequent uses all allowable and ministerial and not discretionary uses, which would mean that they would not be a project under CEQA. Now, there's some debate as to whether that is legally implementable or not. That, you know, could be subject to subsequent legal challenge, but I'm getting out of my element to go further there. If the initiative doesn't pass, then they still have a general plan amendment in the process with the, which the board is authorized for processing. They could ask us to resume processing it subject to board concurrence.
Thanks.
Right. And that action would be subject to CEQA.
That's just the level I needed.
And I don't know if council, I made council twitch or not with that answer. Okay.
Very calm. I had one question on the viewshed ordinance. Do you have any further information? I don't see Mr. Euphrat here as to what the plan is from here.
I basically told you what I know.
Full disclosure. I guess I would like to offer staff as it contemplates going forward with this. One of the things that I heard at the hearing is the idea that we already have viewshed protection standards on the books in a number of our area plans. And the discussion has taken a circuitous path, shall we say, but I think it's time to bring it back to the question of why those why what's on the books shouldn't be implemented elsewhere in the county as appropriate, as part of the discussion and analysis that I heard.
I'm sure that that will be part of the research the staff does and the information brought back to the board.
Okay. Warren, you mentioned that the board had denied a COC appeal. Was that an appeal by the applicant, or was that an appeal by a member of the public? I mean, which way did that decision cut?
Oh, the certificate of compliance. Mm-hmm. That was a request by a private applicant, and they appealed the planning director's determination that they didn't qualify for the number of certificates that they wanted, and the board upheld the staff determination.
Okay, thank you for that. And I understand you and Mr. Hood were at a very important function this weekend. Was there a staff update coming on Live Oak?
Well, actually, I would defer to you because I think you were there also. But thank you.
All right, that's it. Then we'll now move to consent agenda. And is anyone from the public wish to speak on the consent agenda? If not, I bring it back to the commission.
Move approval consent agenda, which is the May 25th Planning Commission minutes.
Mm-hmm. Is there a second?
Second.
Been moved and second. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, so carried. That gets us to item number one. Madam Secretary, may we have that announced, please?
Hearing to consider a request by Cambria Community Services District for a development plan coastal development permit to allow a three-phase geotechnical and hydrogeologic data collection project to aid in the assessment of design alternatives for a future seawater desalination facility in the North Coast Planning Area. County file number DRC 2004-00142, Supervisorial District 2, Martha Nieder, Project Manager.
Thank you, Commissioners. Martha Nieder, County Planning. The Cambria Community Services District provides potable water service to the community of Cambria and to State Parks Campground at San Simeon State Beach. Historically, the CCSD relies on the San Simeon Creek and Santa Rosa Creek aquifers for their water supply. The CCSD uses the San Simeon well field currently, as the Santa Rosa wells are currently shut down due to MTBE contamination. The CCSD has experienced water supply shortages and has been under a water code emergency since November 2001. In order to provide a reliable water supply during the dry season, the CCSD is pursuing the completion of a seawater desalinization project. And the project before you today is for geotechnical and hydrological investigations that will allow for the collection of data to aid in design of this future project. Some technical difficulties.
Is your screen really light?
Whoa. Yeah, blinking at us.
I'm sure that he will. Mm-hmm. Thank you for coming. Mm-hmm.
All right, I'm back in order. Sorry about that. The data collection project consists of three phases. Phase one is to drill approximately 7 exploratory soil borings in locations parallel to and in close proximity to the beach surf zone. Phase one work would also include geophysical exploration with a test vehicle that pushes 1 to 2 inch diameter probes into the sand in the same general area. In phase one, a temporary equipment access ramp would be installed, and that would be left in place for all three phases. The second phase is to install 2 4-inch diameter monitoring wells on the San Simeon Creek beach area and the parking lot beach area, as well as a geophysical survey along the surf zone and ocean floor. Phase three is to drill approximately 17 soil borings along the proposed pipeline alignments and other project elements that are not located within the beach area. Phase three would also include test pumping from the monitoring wells installed under phase two. This graphic shows the locations of the drilling along the beach area. And then these show the locations in the inland area. The project requires an access ramp at the southern end of the existing parking area on the west side of Highway 1. Base would be put down and wood timbers or a a prefabricated ramp would be placed on top by a crane. This ramp would be used to allow drilling equipment to be removed from the beach area each night after work has been completed. And this would stay in place for all three phases, estimated to be approximately 1 month. Here's some more photos of the southern portion of that parking area and the beach area in that location. Parking would be accommodated in the northern part of the parking lot. This photo was taken last Thursday afternoon. There were two cars in the parking lot. The third car was the vehicle I used. There's also parking located across the highway, and then the beach area is accessed by the boardwalk here. That Thursday, there were no cars in that beach area parking lot across from Highway 1. The project site contains many sensitive resources, including wetlands, riparian vegetation, archaeological resources, and marine resources. The project site is also visible from Highway 1, and it's a visitor-serving area. However, the project needs to be located in here just for the nature of the project and the data that needs to be collected. Soil borings are located on past geophysical work that's been done, so they have an idea of what areas they need to test further. The drill holes are located as far away as possible from sensitive resources without compromising the objectives of the study. Further, there have been measures incorporated to reduce the disturbance to the greatest extent feasible and avoid it whenever feasible. The site is proposed to be restored after the completion of each drill hole. Best management practices will be utilized. There's monitoring required by numerous professionals depending on the resources that will be disturbed, and no riparian vegetation will be trimmed or removed during the drilling activities. This is just a short overview. The applicant has a more in-depth presentation and has his consultants here to answer specific questions, but this concludes my presentation, and I'm available for questions. And staff recommends approval based on the findings listed in Exhibit A and the conditions in Exhibit B.
All right, thank you. I have one question. We just received an email here from Elizabeth Bentenhausen, and I don't know who might. I'd like to hear a comment on this email, and I don't know if you want to do it or if County Council, and I don't know if maybe County Council hasn't received it. So
no, I don't have a copy of it.
Do you have it now?
She gave me.
Okay, we'll give you a chance to read it and then talk about it a little later. Would that be all right? Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe the commissioner from the district has something, but you're getting to a fundamental question that many people have asked. So if Mr. Gibson is okay with that, I'd kind of like to get into that piecemealing.
That's fine. I have no questions of staff at this point. I wanted to hear the applicant's presentation first public testimony for that matter.
Okay.
Well, I was kind of hoping to get into the piecemealing kind of up front.
That's so fine. Get that resolved one way or the other.
Right.
Okay.
Well,
did you want to lead off the questioning on that?
It's been brought up in. Let me even back up one step further. It seems to me, in terms of the environmental determination, we find the county acting as a responsible agency.
This is an important project for the Cambria area. This is scientific data gathering and a geotechnical investigation. Here with us today, we have a team of experts who will present factual details of the project. I'd like to introduce them. Dave Kraska, who is with Corolla Engineers, he's the project manager. Eric Snelling is with Padre Associates, who's working with us specifically on the permitting for the project. And Paul Sorensen with Fugro. Also today, who will come up after me, is Bob Gressens, our district engineer. We have with us also our board president, Peter Schaldecott, and director Greg Sanders. They're here to provide policymaking guidance and to respond to any of your questions. So we will be here for the term and be happy to answer questions as they come up. Bob?
All right.
Thank you, Tammy, and thank you, commissioners, for giving us the opportunity to make this presentation today. I appreciate everyone's time, and really appreciate Martha Nieder's efforts in working on the staff report and all her effort behind the scenes. I have a brief PowerPoint presentation, and then we'd be glad to answer detailed questions as they come up. So if we can go to the first slide, I'm going to skip over some of the information that Martha had in her earlier discussion. Basically, some key terms first off. When we talk about a geotechnical and hydrogeological investigation, the geotechnical part is simply characterizing subterranean materials, and the hydrogeologic is characterizing how water moves through those subterranean materials. Next slide. So the purpose of this data collection project is not to really to build anything, but to gather data. We are collecting scientific data so that we can develop future desalination project alternatives. We're hopeful this data will guide us into alternatives that may be better environmentally in the long term, but we don't know until we get that data. So this is basically a data collection effort. We'll have alternatives in a future environmental impact report and environmental impact statement document that'll go through a full public review process and, again, a hearing, and you'll probably see us here again in the future on the desal project. So I want to make that distinction. Basically, what this is about is just we need to collect data so we know what's underground in that area. Next slide. The outline that follows is just, I'll skim through the location of study area since Martha has talked about that. I'll just briefly describe our data collection activities. I'll give you an overview of some of the basic environmental protections. And as Tammy mentioned, we do have our consultant team here today that worked on some of those environmental documents and some of the mitigation measures if there's a detailed concern. And then just wrap up with summary and recommendations. Next slide. You've already seen the study area being near the San Simeon State Beach Campground. Next slide. Our primary study area is closer to the beach, although we have some inland soil borings in a few spots. Next slide. Martha's described this already. I'll just add that any wells that are drilled for the groundwater monitoring will be destroyed at the end of the data collection effort. So there's nothing being left behind that's going to be part of a future project. All the wells will be abandoned at the end of this work. Next slide. One of the areas that we looked at fairly closely in the development of our initial study, Mitigate NIC DEC, is how do we gain access to the beach? And it's a difficult problem, and we believe we came up with a solution that has the least potential to cause environmental impacts as well as be more reliable. Some of the earlier locations, and I'm going to try to use this thing without going. I don't know how the pointer use works. Okay, thank you. Okay, I will. You're going to follow me? Great. Well, we had an earlier route consideration that was through the campground, through some of the roads there, and that would involve crossing the lagoon area, the San Simeon Lagoon, or else trying to go around it somehow. And because there are some listed species there, particularly the tidewater goby, we chose not to go that route. And there's also just practical considerations. We'll probably be doing this work most likely in the fall to winter time. And so there are concerns that the flow would increase following a storm and take out any temporary type of structure that might be there for crossing that creek. So that's the reason that we are looking and recommending that we go forward with a temporary access ramp that's mitigating NIC DEC. And this involves a sound reflection test. And the plan is to put a sound generating device inside an encased groundwater monitoring well. And then we have acoustic type instruments that are very sensitive. They're laid along the ocean floor and also inland above the sea level. That instrumentation is all tied into a computer. It analyzes that to give us an idea of the layering and the structure of the soil that's underneath the water surface there. The cables are placed by divers. Again, there's very sensitive microphones, and then Fugro is permitted by the State Land Conservancy to use this test device. And what we did is we looked at the sound attenuation that occurs in that soil from that device because of the questions that were raised. And we are fairly conservative because you lose the noise level by distance. So we use a fairly short distance here to where that interface is with the ocean. And that came out to about 60 decibels. And that is roughly about normal, non-amplified human conversation level. So we feel comfortable that the attenuation that occurs as the sound travels through the soil and through the casing does address some of the earlier concerns that were raised. Just comparatively, we found that ocean surf, for example, is roughly 75 decibels. So we're less than normal ocean surf sound levels with that device. We back this up also with, and I'll talk about this later, with our mitigation measures, which include some very expert biological monitoring that's both on the boat that the divers are using to observe any behavior of marine mammals and to stop operations if we have any suspicion there's anything affecting marine mammals in the area. Next slide. Oops. That's just the normal 60. Our environmental protections, we want to be good stewards of the environment just as much as anyone else does, and our key approach here is just to avoid any sensitive species. Just avoid those areas and avoid the species. We back that up with expert monitoring by biologists, both habitat, and we also have cultural resource monitors in our mitigations that we'll be using to monitor for that as well. The adopted mitigation measures that we included in our October 14th hearing last year are biological, cultural, and geological. And then we also have developed contingency plans such as wildlife contingency plans and a hazardous spill contingency plan. Next slide. So on cultural resource protection, we have no unnecessary excavations, no equipment staging on undisturbed portions of an archaeological site. There's no collection, removal, or unnecessary displacement of any artifacts or cultural remains. We have control units where we're doing hollow stem augering, where they'll be 1 by 1 meter in area to make sure we're not disturbing architectural remains. And we have the qualified archaeological monitoring called out. Next slide. Okay, thank you. Oops, can you go back? Thank you. Just concluding here, we have a data collection is needed to develop our desalination project alternative. So it's to help us develop a better EIR, EIS document in the future. Our future EIR, EIS will have, its own public review process and environmental clearance process that we have to go through. We have already adopted mitigation measures, and I believe the permit conditions reflect that as well, to avoid and protect the biological, cultural, and geological resources. And we recommend that you approve our project for a permit. So at that point, I'll close, and I'd be glad to answer questions. And I suppose we could start off with the one if you wish, or we can hold off. However you want to do that, we're flexible.
Any questions?
I've got a couple, but maybe the piecemealing question, if county council is ready to speak to that, might be the appropriate one.
Well, I would let staff respond somewhat to that first, but I would indicate that my understanding is that the district is the lead agency and has prepared a mitigated negative declaration, and the staff is involved in the process all the way along. And so our role as a responsible agency is to review and consider the information contained in the documents that have been prepared.
Address this issue?
I think it's when the mitigated negative declaration is prepared by the district. as well as when we're involved in it. If we weren't involved in the process, then I think there would be a shift of emergency status. But my understanding is that we've been involved all the way along.
So any subsequent action that was taken, legal action that was taken on the part of the public, should that happen, would the county would be, a party, a named party, or
I
would be a
probably,
party?
Probably, but okay. it's the district's document at this point.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. I'd like to ask the applicant, I'm sure you read these concerns of people that this perhaps should have been an EIR covering the entire project from this data collection phase through the eventual project. Could you speak for a moment as to why you didn't choose to do that? And I've heard you say you can gather some data and then when you finish, no one will ever know you were there.
That's correct, and I also will point out, too, that Mr. Art Montanen is here with us today. He's our district counsel, and so I may defer to Art if there's a legal question on this. I won't attempt to answer those questions. I can say from a logical standpoint, we're trying to do a better job on EIR, and yes, we are planning to leave this in an undisturbed state when we're out of there. This is to collect data, and it's not to build anything, it's to collect data. So you have to have good data to make good decisions and to develop good alternatives. And when we use that data, we're going to be looking at what are some of the potential environment impacts with alternative A, B, C, D, and that's part of what's going to come into that environmental document. So it's just from logic alone, we need to get the data first before we can do that step.
But the very fact that this data is required in order for you to move forward with a larger project that is going to presumably include beach wells, I mean, which is the whole purpose of monitoring the hydrogeology of that area, it would seem that the data collection is without question a part of the larger project. You're going to drill the wells to get the data to determine where the beach wells should go and how they should be constructed.
Well, again, if we don't know whether we're going to use beach wells or not at this point. That would be an alternative we would look at. But, again, there's a chance that this information is going to say that's not the way to go. So we have to come up with a different alternative.
So you're suggesting you might get data that says this will not work. We got to go to Plan B.
Right, and we just don't know what's down there. That's why we have to do the exploratory.
Hasn't the district already done some exploratory work in this area? I seem to recall some sonic testing that's already gone on.
The testing that's been done is geophysical in nature, and that doesn't give you the resolution you need to know what the specific characteristics are of the soil, from both how water travels through it as well as what's there. They have done ground penetrating radar, and it gives you an idea how deep the alluvial material is. So that's the distance from, say, the beach down to the bedrock below. There's been also some microgravity geophysical work, which again doesn't involve sampling material. That's just walking with a special device along the beach. So that gives you that backed up some of that information, telling us roughly how deep that material is, but it doesn't really tell you what it is, and that's what we're after.
So just to confirm, in terms of developing the project that would be the desalination plant, do you have any development on that project, or are you waiting the results of this?
We're waiting the results of this to develop alternatives, so we're not building anything that's going to be used as part of that project. We're collecting data, and then that'll tell us which alternatives we need to focus on and go from there and work that into the subsequent project EIR, EIS.
And you, in your consideration of the mitigated negative declaration, I saw that there were comments registered as to the question of piecemealing, to which you responded there. And I wonder if Mr. Montanen might speak to your conclusions as regards how you justify, if you will, your mitigated negative deck as the proper document here.
Okay. I'll turn it over. Thanks, sir.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Art Montand, and I'm District Counsel for the Cambria Community Services District. First of all, I'd like to state that I concur with Mr. Orton's conclusion regarding the county's role in this, but nevertheless, be happy to respond to any questions regarding piecemealing. My analysis of the piecemealing issue is that the classic piecemealing is when you have a project that's being...
Well, the data collected in this experiment or series of experiments might show up in the EIR, EIS for the actual building project that you come forward with?
Absolutely, and what may happen if this proves to be infeasible, it may not appear because this part of the beach won't be used for the project at all.
Okay. That's it on that question. I have other issues, like a little more information on.
From which person?
Well, it has to do with the seismic reflection survey and whether Bob can answer that or others. There was some confusion as to the size of the seismic source there. The State Lands Commission issues a permit that doesn't require an EIR if the energy into the source is less than 2 kilojoules. In another place, I saw the analysis that you forwarded to the commission was that the source was a 1.5 kilojoule. Sparker, is there a clear sense of what source is going to be used?
Yeah, I'm going to have to refer to maybe one or two of our consultants to make sure I have it in my head right. But
yeah, and the other question while referring this sort of related is in the state lands permit to use the mini Sparker less than 2 kilojoules, is that don't need an EIR condition for use of that mini Sparker in the water column, which is a very different energy regime than if you're using it from the well?
That's my understanding, but I'm going to ask maybe Eric Mishy or Eric Snelling from PADRE, who's here today, who worked on the mitigation measures and did some of the research. We also, I know Mr. Kraska worked on that as well. But my understanding is that the mini Sparker was designed for use in open water use.
And
so
that's
it's usually
the
towed behind a boat rather than...
Yeah, that's the normal application of it. And is the state lands determination that you don't need an EIR for a mini Sparker less than 2 kilojoules used in the water? Is that their assumption in granting that no EIR?
Yeah, let me confirm that with Eric. So, Eric, you want
to... Hello, Eric Snelling with PADRE Associates in San Luis Obispo. Yeah, we've been working with State Lands Commission on this issue, and Fugro West, who would be doing the work, has a standing permit with State Lands Commission. And it's as long as the sound source is less than 2 kilojoules. So I think it depends on the exact type of equipment they would be proposing to use. But as long as they stay below that threshold, there's no need for any further environmental review from a State Lands Commission point of view.
Okay.
Also, I'd like to mention that there is the open water sound source would travel much further than what's being proposed here, which is the sound source would be placed down in a monitoring well, and it would be passing through sand and soil before it reaches the water. So that attenuation is much greater than if it was placed in open water.
And that really, that was the essence of my question, is the permit from the state, the standing permit for the State Lands Commission for the use of a less than 2 kilojoule mini Sparker in the water? Is that
That's what's typically done,
right.
More typical than what we're proposing, yes.
Okay. When you say typically, is this like the first time you've ever put it down a well, or is this sometimes done?
I would defer to Fugro West to speak to that. That this is their bread and butter.
Yeah.
But I would say that this technology is used in all different ways, downhole in a monitoring well or in the open water. Open water is the more common use of the technology.
And maybe they could come up and...
Yeah, and that would be a question for whoever's in charge of the reflection survey. How many shots with the mini Sparker? Is it in each hole? What depth are you looking to survey? How many geophones? Things like that.
My name is Paul Sorensen. I'm a hydrogeologist with Fugro West. As Eric stated, the more common application is open water. Fugro has conducted these tests down boreholes, but it is more commonly used in open water. Mm-hmm. I can't answer how many geophones would be used in the string. One of the primary intents of the investigation is to tie together some previous geophysics works that have been done offshore with some of the onshore work that Mr. Gressen's referred to with the ground-penetrating radar. And that gives us an idea that ties together those two strings of information, mm-hmm. Which is real critical to the potential water source for the plant.
Well, let me ask a question a different way. As I looked at the the aerial that showed where the reflection survey was going to be conducted, it looked like you might be putting the mini sparker in two or three wells up at the northern end of the profile. Is that correct?
Yeah, we plan on two.
With cables running offshore.
Yes.
And how would the whole survey be done in a day, in an hour, in a week?
The whole survey would be done in a day.
Okay. And that's...
Well, we have the technical guys up there. At the project description talks about drilling, a rotary core, ultrasonic drilling rig, and then we have the mini sparker. I'm kind of merge them together, but I guess they're two separate things. So I understand how you drill a hole, like on dry land with drilling mud and stuff. How are you going to drill a hole with a ultrasonic drilling rig? How does that work?
I'll give it a shot, and I may defer to Paul on this as well. Essentially, the rotary core ultrasonic drill rig is fairly new technology. It doesn't require drilling mud, and it will put a right at the very tip of the drill rig, the engine running, and it drives a hydraulic motor, and that's what runs the equipment.
Okay. You're talking about the noise at the surface, but I'm concerned
right.
about down deep, which, again, transmitting to the environment, bothering marine mammals mm-hmm. or mollusks mm-hmm. or what have you. Is that
yeah.
been analyzed?
No.
So there are no studies about the impacts of the ultrasonic sound waves, whether in decibels or kilojoules. You don't know of any studies about the impacts of those technologies on species in the environment?
I know of a study where it was actually done in a similar environment with no impacts, where they used the same drilling methodology on a state beach with sensitive marine mammals and also the snowy plovers around it. This has been done at Doheny State Beach recently by the Metropolitan Water District of Orange County. They use the same drilling technology down there that we're proposing. Now I'll have to defer to our technical team because I don't know myself the answer to that question, but maybe I can pose whether anyone here has it.
Yeah, Eric Snelling, just to point out something is that during the drilling activities, one of the measures included in the MND was for biological monitoring to ensure an adequate buffer zone is maintained between the drill rig and any overwintering snowy plovers that may be on the beach. So the biological monitors would be out there and have authority to stop work if there was plovers coming towards the work zone or if there was any change in behavior from the plovers. But we have, as Bob stated, information and proof on the ground that the plovers are not disturbed by this drilling technology. Also, I would say that, the drilling is going to be, quite a ways away from the surf zone. Any marine mammals would be monitored to ensure that they're not coming within the work zone or within an appropriate buffer zone.
I understand that you know of other projects that have used this technology, and I also understand that there are going to be monitors on site checking snowy plover activities. But my question is, do you know of any studies, any scientific peer-reviewed studies that have documented the impacts of these types of sonic, either the sonic drilling rig noise or the mini sparker noise on marine species, not limited that species to snowy plover, but also, you know, we've got other endangered species there, the steelhead, the tidewater goby. Yeah.
During the MND process, I did review literature provided by the drilling company that's being proposed for use that provided sound level information and how that attenuates away from the source. So in my review of their information, it appeared to be, it's insignificant.
Okay, but other than information supplied by the industry, you don't know of any scientific peer-reviewed studies about the impacts on these species?
No, ma'am.
Okay.
Do you know the energy level of the ultrasonic drilling probe?
The energy level?
Right.
Not off the top of my head, but it is enough to, through the vibration and the rotary action, it is able to cut through cobbles. And that's why this technology has been selected, so that it is going to be a sure bet to get quality data that the district needs in designing their project.
Does anyone else, like Mr. Sorensen, know? He's shaking his head no.
Okay.
My recollection of the State Lands Commission letter was that if there was any question or disagreement about whether or not a specific technology was going to exceed the 2 kilojoule level, that the final determination would be made by the State Lands Commission. We've heard today that using the mini sparkers down the well would actually decrease the noise impacts in the water. But I'm wondering if perhaps the reverse may be true, if it may work like a megaphone, essentially, and concentrate the noise. So has State Lands been asked to make a determination about how the kilojoule level of the mini sparkers is affected, either increased or decreased, by its use in a well as opposed to its more typical use in the water column?
Let me refer to Eric on that one, too.
In our discussions with State Lands Open Water, it will be, at the 60 decibel level. So, through our study and Corollo's study, that we feel that this is a less than significant impact, and we've included mitigation to reduce any impacts that might occur.
Are we talking apples and oranges, or maybe, yen and... I mean, we're talking about kilojoules on the one hand and decibels on the other. I'm not a sound engineer. Is it... I don't know if that's the same parlance or not.
Yeah. Well, let me go back to your first question, I think. And that's the sound level being amplified. If the sound is reduced by distance fairly rapidly... So if you have a reflected wave, it's going to travel much further distance through the sound-absorbing soil before it reaches that interface with the water. So it's going to be less than the 60 decibels that we showed. We are conservative in coming up with the 60 decibels because we use a fairly short distance through that soil matrix. But if you are bouncing waves off, say, the bedrock below and trying to travel a long distance to get to that ocean interface, you're going to lose a lot more of the decibel level by the time it hits that point. And that's essentially what these geophones are doing when they're being analyzed in the computer, is they're looking at the variations in the sounds, and they're looking at very, very minimal measurements of sound.
Maybe I could help a little bit here. The 2 kilojoule or the kilojoule rating of a mini sparker works like this. You charge up a big capacitor and then discharge it into a pair of electrodes. The spark vaporizes the water, makes a sound wave that emanates away. The 2 kilojoules is how much energy you're putting into that process. The decibel measurement is a measure of the intensity of the energy as it radiates away from where it starts, and it does decrease with distance, and it does decrease with a whole bunch of other factors that Corollo engineers, endeavored to analyze in this Appendix E that you furnished us via email. It's to be distinguished from the sonic drilling rig, which is like an impact hammer, if you will. You've used a rotary impact hammer trying to chip up some concrete. As I understand, the sonic drilling rig is just using a bit of vibration to try to break through the cobble so you can drive the core into the ground. Now, it too will produce a certain level of sound, and as I understand, Mr. Snelling has looked at the decibel levels of that process, and you have some documentation as to how much noise it creates at the point that it's doing it. So we are, in a sense, talking apples and oranges.
That was very helpful, Commissioner Gibson. Thank you for that clarification. I just want to state why I'm concerned about these issues. And while we don't have any scientific peer-reviewed studies about the impacts of sound on the species in this area, there's been a lot of documentation around the world about the impacts of sonic testing on marine mammals. Now, the military denies that there's any link, but I think anyone who's credible in the field will acknowledge that there can be very severe lethal impacts on marine mammals and, you know, possibly other marine wildlife associated with sound waves. Again, I'm not a sound engineer, and so I don't know if this type of sound wave is the same type of sound wave that causes the kind of lethal effects on marine mammals in other types of sonic-related testing that has gone on in and around the ocean and the marine environment. So that's what the core of my concerns are. I mean, I don't have any evidence before me to say that these impacts would occur, but I don't know enough about the technology at this point to feel comfortable that they wouldn't. So that's the kind of information that I'm trying to get my hands on. And if somebody can clarify the difference between those types of sound testing, monitoring, and these types of sound tests, I'll
And I know nothing about a mini sparker other than what Mr. Gibson has just described, but I do know military sonar, having been a military sonar technician. It's quite different. There it's kind of like a loudspeaker where they set out a particular tone at a particular frequency, so therefore you have a concentration of energy at, you know, 5 kilohertz or 2 kilohertz or whatever the frequency is, which obviously is concentrated. If you're having some collapsing of a bubble, the noise would be over a very wide spectrum of frequencies, and much...
Mr. Chairman, we're still hearing from the applicant, and we have the public here, but
the rest of applicants, and after we hear public testimony, let me bring a little of my technical background to bear on the discussion.
All right.
We're flanked by engineers. We're well represented here. That's great.
Thank you. Okay, is there more from the applicant?
No. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Is the applicant finished? Okay. I'm sorry, I didn't understand. Then next we'll go to the public, and we have several slips. First is Jack Monroe, and then Connor Evans, I think it is. Well, the first one is speaking. The second one can be getting ready so we can move right along. We have two speaker stands.
Thank you very much. The time's already going. My name is Connor Everts, and I represent the Southern California Watershed Alliance. The name's CONNEREVERTS. I also represent a statewide group called the DesalResponseGroup.org. We've been meeting for over 4 years with utilities on the issues of coastal desalination plants. We still have more questions than answers, as seemingly you may too. I realize that ocean water desalination is a sexy supply source. There's a lot of engineering involved, but you're also groping with the same questions everyone is along this coast. After being on the state desal task force, we did not come up with statewide guidelines, so we're all relying project by project. I was also on the review committee, so I've reviewed this project, I have to say project because the word keeps coming up, project. It sure looks and sounds like a duck to me that this is piecemealing, despite the best efforts to bring this forward as pieces of a future environmental review. I would suggest the statewide implications of this require that you do not accept the staff report and that you look into this really as a much larger project that it may be. And we also need to fully look at the alternatives. My background, being elected to the Water Conservation and Water District in Western Ventura County when both Santa Barbara implemented a plant, which is not being used now after much expense, and Ventura decided not to, despite a public vote, leads us to looking at maximizing conservation, which is my background as chair of the California Urban Water Conservation Council, and fully implementing both reclamation and the potential for cisterns, which I understand are available but not hooked up. So I hope you take all these considerations and you take the time to fully look at what will be the first on the Pacific Coast to supply water directly. And lastly, the Coastal Commission has asked you to look at the whole series of permits that are required from the many agencies. Someone actually did a matrix and makes it look like there's perhaps 17 stops you might have to make before you move forward. I thank you for this time, and I thank you for letting us speak. I actually have to sadly leave this area where I have been visiting my aunt and uncle in Cambria for about 15 years now and go back to San Diego County Water Authority, where they're proposing a much larger plant, but the issues are the same for all of us. Thank you very much. And if there are any questions, I'll stay for a moment.
Okay, any questions? Apparently not. Thank you. Mr. Jack Monroe and then Mala Burton.
Good morning. Yeah, the last name is Morrow, M-O-R-R-O-W.
I couldn't read what the last letter was.
It's like Morrow Rock with a W on the end of it.
All right, I'm sorry. Thank you.
I represent the Sierra Club this morning, the executive committee of which I'm a member. I'm also vice chair of the chapter. Andrew Christie is here, and he just turned his slip in, but he's going to be speaking also on behalf of the Sierra Club. Would it be permissible if he joined me up here or spoke right after me?
He'll have his chance to speak.
Okay, we have submitted written comments to the commission. And, they're basically our answers to the MND that we received from the CCSD, and I request that those be part of the record. I would like to note in opening my talk here that the CCSD did review our comments and have responded favorably to several of them, and we appreciate that. However, there are a couple of what I would consider policy-level matters that really haven't been addressed in their response. Some of it's been already referred to here and talked about. First of all, we believe this request should be supported by an environmental impact report. Our reasons are, first off, the California Environmental Quality Act specifies that a piecemeal approach is not permissible where the overall project requires an EIR. We think it is generally agreed by the ocean. I would like to know whether this is a possibility. This is in the nature of a question to the gentleman here. Whether there's a possibility of that, and if there is, would this drilling then be considered as part of this mitigated negative declaration, since it's not mentioned in anywhere in their proposal? I learned last night at a meeting that some engineers have said that that's a fairly likely probability. So I think it should be answered here.
Sir, you're run out of time. Can you wind up your comments?
Yeah, my other comment was in regard to the mini sparker itself and the issue of the two not more than or less than. I think that's been pretty well covered. I would point out in answer to Sarah Christie's question or partial answer to that about studies that the general permit they have to do this study was issued by the State Lands Commission on the basis of a mitigated negative declaration there. So it, as far as I can determine, has never been subject to a full environmental impact report, which might have generated some of the studies that Ms. Christie is talking about. So that's another reason we think that an environmental impact report, it wouldn't be really onerous, and I think it would reveal a lot of information that we don't have on a scientific basis. So thank you. I'll take any questions you might have.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Apparently not. Thank you. Mala Burton and then Richard Harley.
I'm Mahala Burton, and I'm a resident of Cambria. I'm an independent person. And thank you for hearing my comments. This project is not just a simple project such as digging a water well. I own ranch land, and I know how easy that can be and how difficult. This is going to be a large scientific project. It's not going to take merely a month. I have never heard of any project taking a month. The permit is issued for 2 years from the time of vesting. So for a temporary one-month project, why would you need a two-year permit? This project is going to utilize this giant ramp. It's 12 feet wide by 40 feet long. There are no final plans. It's going to go on a parking lot. You saw the photos. Those photos were taken with a wide-angle lens that did no justice to actually this narrow lot. It's dirt. It's on an eroding bluff down to a very popular beach access, even though planning staff has said they've only seen one or no cars there. I live 2 miles from this site. Constantly, all year long, there are people pulling in and pulling out, large motorhomes, campers, vehicles of all sorts. Maybe there's only 3 or 4 cars at a time, but they use that lot. It's an access for disabled people. They may not get down the eroded ramp, but they surely can sit and look at the ocean. Planning staff would have people divert it to a lot across the street, down below grade, without any signs that it even exists. People would have to walk on a short boardwalk underneath the highway, underneath the bridge, and then another total quarter of a mile, no place for disabled people, people with children. No views, so that's not acceptable. Planning staff has said that there are only a maximum of 8 car trips. Well, how can there be only 8 car trips for a project of this scope? That makes no sense. 1 car in, out, going to lunch, that's 4 trips. So are there only going to be 2 cars? No, that's not right. Now this ramp, and I only have a few more minutes. State Parks has even said in their letters that are in the project packet that this beach where the ramp is going to go down is a place of dynamic weather. I've seen storms, and the tide hits the toe of the bluff. So we're going to have 24/7 a ramp sitting on the beach for well over a month with no fencing on it, because how can you fence something sitting on a public beach with lateral access? Now, that's what you call an attractive nuisance in a legal term. We have plenty of lawyers here, so they can explain what that means. Any child walking along will want to climb up it. There's liability. There's a lot more work that needs to be done on this project. It needs a full EIR. It is piecemealing. And just my final thing I'd like to say is that this project could be completely avoided if the Cambria Community Services District would cease seeking desalination as a new water source and instead put its money and manpower into developing a recycled water delivery and storage system and putting teeth into its conservation efforts. Desalination was chosen by the current board of directors after an advisory vote was sent to ratepayers and the 650 lot owners on the water wait list that, for the most part, are not Cambria residents.
I'm coming out of Santa Rosa Creek. I think the state parks has a conflict of interest in even commenting on this because they receive water from the district and will receive desalinization water for their future expansion of state park issues there with additional campers and showers and so forth. I think further to support the piecemeal issue here, the district has applied for Prop 50 grant funds for the desal plant in 4 different categories. I think Mr. Gibson has supported that also. And again, falls right into the piecemeal thing. This is part of the project. The mini sparker issue is based on a permit that was given in 1984. 20 years old, new technology, new information, all leads to my understanding that at least a focused EIR ought to be put on this. Thank you so much.
A question for Mr. Hawley. As a resident of Cambria, did you have the opportunity to go to the services district and make your piecemealing concerns known to them?
Well, if you read the staff report, you'd see my letter in there. Thank you. I addressed all of those issues that I brought up today.
And did you receive a response from them
at
meetings?
I read the responses, sir. Okay. I did.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you. Next is Mr. Andrew Christie.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Andrew Christie. I'm Chapter Coordinator for the Santa Lucia Chapter of the Sierra Club. Mr. Morrow covered many of our concerns adequately. I would just like to focus in on the mini sparker question primarily and also underscore the point Mr. Hawley just made. This is based on a decision by the State Lands Commission from 1984. I suggest you read that letter carefully. They're basically saying it was fine then, and we have seen some studies, or rather projects in 1987. We looked at them again. Everything seems to be fine. And that's pretty much the level of study that's gone into this since then. I can assure you there have been many studies on acoustics and seismics in the marine environment since 1984 that probably should be considered in this project. Mr. Gresson's diagram appeared to measure sound waves traveling through soil to be received by microphones in the surf zone, did not appear to measure the continuation of those sound waves through the water of the surf zone after it reached the microphones. He also pointed out that the noise level of surf is 75 decibels. If we don't have a measurement for the water or the sound waves moving through the water, I think we should just add 60 plus 75 to get a background noise level for the marine environment. That's 135 decibels. And as we pointed out in our comments to you, fish have shown sensitivity to even very moderate sound levels. Gray whales have shown avoidance behaviors, including migratory changes in their migratory pattern changes at about 115 decibels. This also indicates the need for further study of the sonic impacts of the mini sparker. We noticed that the study mentioned by Mr. Snelling and Mr. Gresham's appear to refer only to the ultrasonic drilling rig and not to the mini sparker. Basically, there's just inadequate information on this aspect of the project, and it does indicate the need for an environmental impact report. Thank you.
Mr. Christie?
Mr. Ruth.
I had a concerning the attenuation of the sound after it leaves the I guess the dirt or the sand, and it goes off in the water, was my impression that it would then be further attenuated. So if you had, you know, something at the surface of the soil as it went into the water, 100 feet out, it would be less, and 200 feet out, it would be, again, less. Do you have a different
That's point? True if it was passing through further sound attenuating material. But once a sound source or sound level reaches the marine environment, it's a whole different ballgame than sound traveling through air, sound traveling through water, sound traveling through soil. Three different, very completely different measurements for decibel levels. There are possibilities of sound channels occurring in water at different levels that could actually, as Commissioner Christie pointed out, act as a megaphone, could actually amplify the sound. When you get into the marine environment, you basically have to adopt a whole different form of measurement for decibels traveling through water.
Thank you.
Mr. Christie, you mentioned that fish species have shown sensitivity to sound. Can you describe what some of that sensitivity looks like? If you know, if not.
I do. The study that we referenced in your packets was conducted by A.A. Meyerberg in 1990. It's titled The Effects of Man-Made Noise on the Behavior of Marine Animals. Studies have shown the harmful effects of even moderate noise on the hearing in fish and the viability of fish eggs exposed to noisy environments.
I'm a member of that very same group, and we practice water conservation in Cambria as part of our overall approach to our water problem. So that, to mention that we're not doing water conservation shows to me, illustrates to me that he doesn't know our policies very well. we also do have plans in our urban water management plan for a recycled water system for some of the larger outdoor irrigation areas, as well as providing some recycled water to residents that can truck it in the back of their pickup truck and so forth. So we are doing recycled water as well. As far as the noise level, again, normal conversation level without an amplifier is about 60 decibels, and I've had a number of conversations along the surf zone with my wife as we walk the surf, and I don't think that's being amplified by another 75 decibels above that. So I would dispute that having effects on marine mammals. I also didn't hear what those sound levels were in decibels that affected fish eggs and so forth out of the Meinberg study. So I'd be curious to know that. But the again, I think we've covered the piecemealing question already. The ramp questions that were raised, we can remove that ramp quickly from above the parking lot area. Once the ramp is installed, that same parking lot would be available even with the ramp there during that month. So we're not shutting down the entire parking lot for a month. It's probably going to be shut down for a day or two while we install the ramp, and maybe a day while we take the ramp out because of the equipment that has to go in and out. But we'll still allow some room on the northern part of that parking lot for the few cars that may want to pull over and take a quick look at the ocean and drive on and not go through the effort of parking where the public restroom is at and going underneath the boardwalk. Other than that, I think I'll close there, and we'd be glad to answer questions if I may have missed some of the points that were raised.
I did have one. In phase three, when you do the test pumping, what will happen to that water?
That water is going to be filtered through a bag. There's going to be a bag filter on the discharge end of it. And I do have a slide I could probably put up to show you that. We cut that out of our original presentation because we didn't want to take up much of your
time. I understand it, but a bag, and then it just dribbles down the sand?
Yes, it just gets filtered through a large bag that's okay. And then it just travels down to the beach,
down
to the surf zone.
And it's your understanding that if you took a 60 dB noise source and a 75 dB noise source, you wouldn't get 135 dBs of volume?
Could you repeat that again?
You alluded to it when you talk about conversations on the beach, so if I'm hearing you understand you correctly, if you take a 60 dB noise and a 75 dB noise, they're not added directly, so you don't have 135 dB worth of sound.
Again, I'm going to qualify myself as not being a sound engineer, but I would dispute that that would amplify in that fashion.
Good. Any of them engineers want to take a break at it? Or?
No.
Okay. Any other questions?
Just one, and maybe State Parks could weigh in on the public access issues. Ms. Nieder's photograph of Thursday suggests light use of the parking lot. I take it that parking lot is rarely, if ever, full, and that the amount that you occupy down at the southern end is not going to unduly inconvenience people accessing the beach.
Hi, my name is Ed Redding. I'm the sector superintendent for the San Simeon District. That is a Caltrans pullout. We do have some tables there that probably will be impacted for a period of time, but we do have the Washburn day use area across the road that does allow access to the beach. Obviously, it is going to impact some access, but I think the time of year of this project, it's probably not as busy as certainly the summertime, things like that, so there will still be access.
Thanks. And then, go ahead.
Mr. Redding, the staff report says that the project will require about 15 spaces to be sectioned off for the use of the project operators. How many spaces are there in that parking lot? That will be 15 out of how many spaces?
It's not really delineated, so it's kind of hard to say. I've seen probably 20 to 30 cars in there, but there is also a lot. The lot's not real defined. There's space to the north as well for parking. So,
and you know, a space is relative. I mean, a Volkswagen versus a motorhome. But
yeah,
what I'm hearing is
normally, you know, it's going to be a 9-foot space for a parking spot. You know, I don't know the demand.
The policy memo that had been prepared by State Parks Headquarters. I talked to staff about maybe getting a copy of that and distributing it to commissioners. I don't know if that happened.
Is it relevant to, I mean, is there additional information that would help us with this?
I might just give you the park's perspective on this, and we do allow utilities on state parks. Obviously, you know, we need utilities, and they go through state park properties to get to other private properties as well. So we do allow that. This project specifically is on state park property. Our charge as a state park is to protect the resources, preserve the resources, and provide high-quality recreation to the public. Any project that negatively affects that is a problem to us. We're going to have to allow a right-of-entry permit for this project to be done, which is going to require that all the permits that are needed by any control agency and all the conditions of those permits are met before we allow this project to go forward. So we will be going through our own CEQA process on that as well. You know, and it has no bearing on any future project. We don't have the authority to approve a larger project than this. We can do an exploratory for something, but that's going to be a Sacramento issue, and certainly the project's going to have to be well-defined and meet all the criteria to be allowed by the state parks on their property.
So what that tells me is basically state parks is the last stop of all the permits that need to be obtained by the services district. State parks is going to need to see all of those permits in hand before you issue
it would be a right of entry permit.
A right of entry permit.
The project. And yes, all the requirements of those permits would have to be met.
And that process, the state parks right of entry permit, has its own CEQA review process that it goes through with state parks as the lead agency?
Yes, it does.
Okay. So you are not bound as we are in terms of being a responsible agency. You have your own CEQA process.
Absolutely.
That you'll be engaging.
But they are the responsible agency.
We are the responsible agency. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's on our property. So.
Well, I'm just, you know, I don't know if I want to take up people's time with this or not, but I remain confused about our ability to, you know, not accept this neg deck if we come to the conclusion that it's not, it doesn't adequately mitigate the impacts associated with the project, because the lead agency has already certified it. I'm sort of having a deja vu moment with the PG&E Diablo issue. So what I'm trying to ascertain is if the Department of Parks and Recreation, because it is your property and you have your own mission under state law, which may or may not coincide with the conclusions and mitigations, etc., that have been made in this document and subsequent permits, if state parks will be engaging its own independent CEQA review process that the public can participate in a way that's different from the way they can participate in the process that's before us today.
We do have an internal process that the public is part of, and again, our requirements are going to be that all permits are in place and that all conditions of permits are met. That's going to be by all state and federal agencies. There's federal money involved, so there'll be federal agencies, and all those conditions of those permits need to be met. So.
And that permit is ultimately issued or not by the director of
For this, we can actually do this locally, but it will be signed and approved by Sacramento. For an actual easement, anything like that, that is outside of our district's authority. That is a Sacramento issue.
But
so for the ultimate project, as you know, when it comes forward, that's going to be a completely different process. The right of entry is just to make sure that the permits are in place, that insurance is in place, that you know everyone's protected by insurance and things like that. So,
but the ultimate signatory is the director of state parks, who may or may not delegate that authority to a local representative. Thank you.
All right, then. Thank you very much.
Okay.
All right, I guess the applicant's finished closing remarks. All right, then I'll bring it back to the commission. But first, we're going to take our break, so we'll break until 10:30.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I don't think I have any questions. I didn't know if other commissioners had questions, but I had a couple of comments, and maybe then get to the point of a motion. So if I'm preempting questions, I'm happy to stop.
I've got a number of questions, and I was just happy to hold off till after we heard from the public. So,
okay. Go ahead.
Is that okay?
Fine.
Go ahead.
Let's see. I think it was figure 2-3 in the neg deck that shows a dotted line in yellow saying beach access route. Does that mean access for this is the access route that people will still be able to follow, or is that the access route that the vehicles will be traveling?
A pensive look there.
Oh, I just wrote it in my notes. I haven't actually turned to the page, but I'm happy to do that. The dotted yellow line, Martha, that is broken by light blue triangles,
is right. It's figure 2-3. I think I brought up a similar figure up on the screen. Is that?
Yeah, the yellow line, it's labeled access route, and I just was wondering which access that was referring to.
I believe it's the access route for the rig that would be doing the drilling.
Okay.
Excuse me.
And then can you indicate on there, because the picture's kind of fuzzy, where the ramp will be?
If you turn to the, we have within our staff report,
I know, it's
that
for the
color.
It's for the public, so they can follow along.
Here's the entrance to the parking lot, and the parking lot is in this area, so
okay.
The ramp would be down here.
So will the majority of the traffic will be single directional? Is that correct? I mean, they'll be driving up, they'll be doing their stuff and coming back. There won't be like splitting and going both ways on
right.
The beach. Okay. And then the report itself we talk about seven soil borings, but there's also a reference to 13 drill hole locations. So is there some discretion about where the holes are going to be bored? Is that why there's a difference in the numbers?
I think the applicant can best describe where all of the holes and the wells and the borings will take place. I think they can describe.
I'm just curious as to why there's seven wells but 13 locations. That's the question.
Okay, I'm going to have to count them up in my head, but we have soil borings that are inland. That's part of that number, I believe, if I understand the question correctly. Let me just count them.
Part of the pipeline drillings.
I'm counting 11 real quickly that are inland, 11 or 12 that are inland.
And then two on the beach?
There's seven that are going to be exploratory along the surf zone. That's that yellow dashed line that you just mentioned.
Okay.
And then there's two that have to be located yet that are somewhere in that same general vicinity that are going to be the groundwater monitoring wells.
Okay. So you're not quite sure where those ones are going to go.
Right. And that's going to depend on the findings of the first holes that we core through.
Okay.
There.
So the criteria, what's the criteria for low? I just want to understand what the criteria will be for locating those additional holes that aren't currently delineated. Because I know there had been some proposed in the riparian area that have since been removed from the project. So what criteria is going to be used when you exercise your discretion about the additional holes that are going to be drilled?
Right. Well, again, we're subject to our adopted mitigations and permit conditions as far as
avoiding sensitive species. So that's going to control where we can do our work. And then there's going to be the actual technical information that FUGRO will be analyzing to determine where it would make the most sense. So there's going to be some judgment by the geohydrologist that gets applied after he gets his first set of data from phase one.
Okay. And you had described in your earlier testimony the borings, that basically it was a core that was going to come out. So are there going to be sand stockpiles associated with these drillings, or are they all going to be discrete corings?
The sampling that we have on the beach are going to be discrete tubes that will be removed. So that's not going to be stockpiled.
Okay.
If there is a hollow stem augering machine, that will sometimes cause a little mound of dirt right around the auger part of it. But then that would be right.
So the ramp will not remain, will not need to remain in place for that period of time.
Right. When we go back to destroy that well and abandon it, there may be some equipment back for a short period of time when that occurs at the very tail end.
Will you need to rebuild the ramp at that point, or will the ramp remain in place for the year that you're monitoring the wells?
I am not sure. I have to defer that to FUGRO because I don't know if that could be done by hand or if we need to get a piece of equipment down there. But, it, you know, conceivably, you know, we could put it down there for a day or so to be able to take a piece of equipment down there and destroy the old well and abandon it properly.
But my understanding is it's not just a question of dropping the ramp down. There's an aggregate base that has to go underneath the ramp, and the aggregate base is being proposed to be spread on the parking lot when you're done with it. So my question is that whole structure going to remain in place for the entire year of the project, or is it going to be constructed and deconstructed twice?
It would be pulled out after that roughly one-month period. Whether we have to put it in for a few short days and then take it back out, we'll have to judge that, whether that could be done by hand when we abandon the old wells or if we have to get a piece of equipment in there.
Note to staff, I think the conditions of the permit need to be added to in order to kind of specify all that. There was not a lot of specificity about the removal of the structures, the timing of when they were going to be removed or any conditions associated with their removal. And so I think when we get to that point in the discussion, we need to address those as well. And then thank you, Mr. Gressens, for those questions. There's been mention of the timing of the project avoiding the snowy plover nesting season, which roughly ends at the end of September, is my understanding. But there's also the issue of the overwintering population of the birds in that area of the beach. And in my discussions with Mr. Smith at State Parks, he indicated that actually the population goes up after nesting season because there's quite a large population of birds that use that beach over the winter. And so the staff report talks about avoiding the nesting season, but it doesn't actually delineate when the project, when the activities of the project would be allowed. So does staff have any comments about avoiding impacts to the overwintering birds and when the project might be allowed to go forward with the least impacts?
Well, there'll be a number of things that affect that. One will be the permits that they'll need to get from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which would further delineate when when in-house study activities may occur. They also have the wildlife contingency plan, as well as the biological monitors out there, making sure that impacts to the plovers are avoided.
And I guess that brings me to my next sort of fundamental question. Is it typical that the county issues its land use permits for projects that are taking place or proposed to take place in endangered species habitat before the applicant has done its Section 7 consultations with the applicable federal agencies, Fish and Wildlife in this case, and National Marine Fisheries Service?
Typically when we have projects that do involve those other agencies, what we do is attempt consultation with those agencies. We do that both through the project referral process, and in this case, particularly, we attempted to set up consultation meetings with agencies. U.S. Fish and Wildlife wasn't able to make that meeting, although we did have it with State Parks and Coastal Commission staff. It is typical that we do condition projects that may need other permits, that they provide copies of those permits or verification that no permit is necessary prior to they're authorized to do any work under the permit approval.
Well, and it's always great to coordinate with state agencies, and it's good that staff does that, but that doesn't take away the legal obligation that the applicant has to do a specific Section 7 consultation to get their incidental take permit. And so I guess, given the possibility that the project could be pretty significantly changed as a result of those consultations, and I can't predict what those changes may be, but, the wildlife agencies who are charged with protecting these species, they can get pretty specific. It just seems to me that it would make more sense for the county to require those Section 7 consultations to take place before we issue our land use permit, because it seems like CEQA would dictate that as well, because the mitigations that get added as conditions to the project, I would think, would need to reflect the Section 7 consultation and the incidental take permits. The mitigation sort of drives the point why I think the consultation would make sense to do that up front, but your point is taken that sometimes these agencies require the local permit. So I guess there's a chicken and an egg question, kind of no matter where you start the circle. The wellheads themselves, it was described in the report that they're going to protrude several feet above the sand, but then they may be buried in the winter to avoid wave uprush. I'd be interested to, if there's any kind of illustration or picture about what the wellheads actually look like, and then a discussion about how they're going to be buried in the winter and whether that's going to create some other issues for the recreational use of the beach.
I'll let the applicant describe the wellheads. I may have a figure. I'm not sure if I have one in the file. But while I'm looking for that, maybe the applicant can describe.
Well, I'll just give you a brief description. What I've seen is just a well casing is like a pipe, roughly 6 inches in diameter or so, and it would be, in this case, it would be buried, and a cap would be placed on it, and probably make it a ferrous metal cap so we can locate it with a metal detector, and someone goes out there with a shovel to go find it. You locate it with a global positioning device so you know exactly where it's at, but I think that'd probably be the most prudent thing to do, is just bury it, and then someone would dig it out when we have to get a sample or take the cap off the pipe. And so
why wouldn't you just leave it buried all year round?
I guess we could. I suppose we could bury it. I think while we're working out there, it would make sense to have it above,
sure,
above ground.
But I'm thinking about the impacts for the recreational and aesthetic and recreational use and aesthetic enjoyment of the beach in this area for the year that those test wells are going to be installed. And if there's these cement aprons and these tall, it said 3 feet above the sand. I don't know if it's a pipe or if it's a box. I don't really have a mental image of what that looks like, but I'm thinking if it could be buried for part of the year, why couldn't it be buried all year so that the public doesn't have to,
I think we're flexible on that, and I believe it would look sort of like a 6-inch diameter pipe roughly, okay, sticking maybe 3 feet above the ground if it was above ground with a cap on the end, or otherwise we could bury it. And
there was some description of a steel locking box and of 3 feet cement apron and some.
Well, let me check with our technical,
okay,
team here real quick.
It sounded like it had the potential to be big and ugly.
the appearance of the well or non-appearance, if it's buried, can be, we're leaving that flexible because it could be at the discretion of an agency that wants to address that. Now, in a few years ago, if you will remember the Avila Beach studies that were going on, the final conclusion of the regulatory agency, I can't tell you which one made the final decision, but was that they preferred, rather than bury, they preferred a large stand standing up, clearly marked with bollards around it and so on, so that it was clearly visible, so that there weren't any incidental problems with it. Now, what we're anticipating here is that that would not be the preferred method, but would rather be buried. And so, you know, it's not that it's going to be above ground sometimes and buried sometimes. I mean, we can go either direction.
It just seems like, you know, the nature and the character of the beach in this part of the coast, less obtrusive was probably better than more.
Right, and we would presume that's going to be the case, in which case we could, as Mr. Gressen's described, we could bury it and then come back in the few times a year when we need to monitor it and dig it out, monitor it, cover it back up.
Okay.
Just to segue off that, are we or are we not going to have a concrete around it? It sounded in one case that there was, in one case there was not.
Well, we're not going to have a big vault. I mean, you know, it's not going to be a big concrete structure. There will be some stabilizing, seal or structure around it, but that would be removed along with the
But that would be down low, out of sight.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, you're not going to have, like, the typical home well pad has a 3-foot by 5-foot concrete.
No, not for
pad.
Not for a well like this.
Okay, so just be a big PVC pipe.
Right, with a steel sleeve over it.
Right.
I mean, yeah.
And then the report indicated that the holes when the wells were removed would be backfilled with a concrete bentonite slurry. And my recollection is that bentonite is one of those sort of prohibited discharge materials by the regional board, and fill it without creating a public safety hazard. You know, I think that would be preferable, but your condition is requiring the bentonite concrete, and I wonder what it just seems odd to me to have this solid core in the middle of a beach sand in a dynamic area where there's wave uprush and lots of action going on. I can see area times of the year where there's going to be this big cement thing sticking out of the sand as the sand gets pulled away.
Well, that destruction, we're talking about 30, 40 feet below ground. You know, we're not talking about above the surface. We won't have this bentonite plug standing up, if that's what you're referring
to. I think it was to 5 feet. There'll be 5 feet of sand over it. But
below ground.
Right.
Right.
Right. I don't know if 5 feet is I've seen beaches be pretty dynamic. 5 feet of sand can
That's part of the process, too, is to understand just how much sand we're going to gain or lose during a season.
My final line of questioning for staff has to do with impacts to public access. And I understand that the public is not going to be physically excluded from the beach for this period of time, that they'll have, you know, a place where they can park, and they'll have an opportunity to get to the beach, and when they're on the beach, they can walk around the beach. But I do think that the quality of the recreational experience and the public access experience of the beach during this time is going to be diminished by the project, particularly during the months that the heavy equipment and the activities are going on. And I mean, I'm sympathetic to those families who have been, you know, waiting all year to take their 1 or 2 week vacation and camp at San Simeon Park. And they get there, and there's cranes and drill rigs and, you know, piles and noise. And I can see the dismay on their faces. And I racked my brain to try to come up with some ways to mitigate the impacts to the beach experience there for the public. And I really couldn't come up with any. But I did consult the CZLUO regarding public access standards to see what kind of conditions we might be able to put on the project to enhance public access elsewhere in the vicinity to sort of maybe in a long-term way kind of offset the admittedly temporary but I think significant impacts to public access related to this project. And I think we're pretty clearly authorized to do that under 23.04.420, which says public access from the nearest public roadway to the shoreline and along the coast shall be provided in new development in projects except where, and it goes to list a number of exclusions, none of which apply to this project from my read of the ordinance. So I guess I'm asking staff and maybe even the CSD if they have any suggestions about public access, or maybe the commissioner from the district may have some ideas about additional public access opportunities in the North Coast that haven't yet been realized that may be addressed as a permit condition for this project so that at the end of the day, what we have is an improved situation relative to public access rather than a one that's diminished temporarily but significantly. Are there any comments?
Well, I guess the way I look at it, and as I understand the project, yes, there's going to be a temporary, and I would guess I would have to characterize it as minor impact on public access. It's not the entirety of the parking lot that's going to be used. There is alternative parking that I know is significantly underutilized across the highway on the other side. It seems to me that the only necessary mitigation would be proper signage for alternative parking in the event that parking's not available in the lot. And I would submit that actually looking at that boardwalk, which gives you a little tour of the riparian area, might be a nice little thing to do, is to take a walk down under the bridge and come. It doesn't seem to me, doesn't strike me that for the 1 month that's anticipated here, that we have a significant public access issue. I was looking through the neg deck here to see how the particular impact to public access was characterized. But
agree, and I agree.
You know, people go to that campground so they can go to the beach. And when they get to the beach, what they're going to have is rigs driving up and down the length of the beach, cranes, drill rigs, heavy equipment, noise. They're not going to have the experience, I think, that they were anticipating. And I think that that's unfortunate. It may be unavoidable, but I think it's unfortunate. And I think that to do right by the public, we should go take the extra step to try to address that in a...
I think the service district has a...
Yeah, Tammy Rudock, General Manager, Cambria CSD. We were just kind of chatting when the idea got brought up, and it's certainly nothing that I can guarantee, but we do have a trolley service in Cambria that we work with the Regional Transit Authority. If something could be worked out and it were feasible for that temporary time period and people had to alternatively park along Windstone Beach or some other areas, maybe we include that as a trolley stop. But I don't know the details of that. I can just say that we could look into it and see if it were feasible.
All right, thank you. All right, any other?
Well, I have a couple of comments. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of discussion about whether or not there was adequate review. In my opinion, there was adequate review. Considering all the other agencies that are responsible for the permitting of this project, temporary project, I think it's going to be adequately covered. And I guess some comments that we hear, we actually have a small desal plant at Diablo Canyon. We have desal plants that are working all over. We have excellent conservation measures that I know Cambria is using. If information gathered from this temporary project can help them alleviate some of the difficulties they're having with the water supply, I think it's more than appropriate that we work with them and approve this development plan.
If there are no other questions, let me just run run a couple quick comments to the commission here. The county does find itself again in the role as responsible agency here. It is exactly as Commissioner Christie says, deja vu of the PG&E hearing of January. Hopefully, it won't take 11 hours to conclude our business here today. But I think the county does, as I indicated at the PG&E hearing, have an important responsibility to review the environmental materials presented to us. And having done so, I think they're basically in order. As to the question of piecemealing, I don't come to the conclusion that this is piecemealing. It is data gathering, and the project to be developed, if one is to be developed, is yet to be developed, pending results from this survey. Furthermore, this could probably be couched as environmental work for a putative future project. And I think one of the important aspects here is there is no permanent structure, no permanent change to the environment that occurs because of this. The other major topic that was brought up was sound, the level of sound in the marine environment. And let me speak to that as an informed layman. Let me just for the record state that I do have a doctorate in geophysics, and my specialty within that field was reflection seismology. I should also emphasize that I am not licensed as a geophysicist or a geologist in this state, so I'm not speaking as an expert. But within the knowledge that I have over the years I spent in that field, I looked at the Appendix E that Mr. Gressens provided us as a matter of email, and I would just love to spend a couple hours walking you through all the assumptions, Bruce. But
we'll give you 3 minutes.
But I don't have a chalkboard unless I can write on the walls here. I've come to the conclusion that it is a conservative estimate of sound levels in the marine environment. There are a number of assumptions. Mr. Gressens referenced the fact that the calculations in Appendix E do not take into account the fact that sound is actually absorbed. They're just talking about sound spreading out. So I come to the conclusion that sound levels in the ocean are conservatively estimated by Appendix E, but I think the more important fact from the aspect of this project is that there are marine life monitors of proper qualifications on site, that the actual amount of time that this survey is going to be underway is relatively limited, and just to speak to Commissioner Christie's concerns. Indeed, the nature of the level of sound with a mini sparker discharged in water versus one discharged in the solid surface is tremendously different, and there will be a tremendous attenuation of that sound. And couldn't find it just now, but I do remember seeing it. And whether there's some flexibility that can be offered there, I think indeed, and it should be the case, since you're only boring through loose alluvial material, that a natural collapse and filling of that well would be the preferred means of abandoning it. But whatever the state standard is, we have to adhere to that unless we can show the natural collapse of that well is sufficient. So with those two potentially modified conditions, we get some specific language, I'd be ready to move approval.
Actually, there's one more modified condition, and it really is an easy one. There was a reference made to the trash being removed regularly from the site. Due to the fact that this is snowy plover habitat, due to the fact that corvids, ravens, and crows, and also seagulls are some of the major predators of snowy plover young and eggs, and given the fact that human generated garbage in construction sites is well known and well documented to attract those species, I'd like to see that condition revised to require daily removal of garbage as opposed to regular removal.
Okay.
That would be condition number 15, and regularly would be changed to daily. For the removal of the ramp and other temporary anchorages, we would recommend a new 1E, removal of the temporary ramp and temporary anchorages for the winching system, and the parking area returned to its pre-construction state shall occur within We were suggesting 15 days of completion of the project.
That sounds reasonable if that is reasonable with applicants.
In addition, there's a typo on condition 3. It uses TAT, and it should be that, THAT.
Would you mind repeating that to make sure I caught everything?
Sure. Removal of the temporary ramp and temporary anchorages for the winching system and the parking area returned to its pre-construction state shall occur within 15 days of completion of the project.
Okay. I think, you know, if we had to come back and use equipment to remove the monitoring wells, I'm assuming that would also be related to completion of the project. I'm assuming that's part of that interpretation.
If we interpreted it that way, the result would be the ramp would be left in place for the entire year.
Well, I think we just have to get the wording right. We would take it out per that condition after our initial three phases are done. But then if we had to come back and reconstruct it in order to remove the old wells, then I want to have a little flexibility at the tail end of that one-year monitoring of the groundwater table and so forth that we could come back, conceivably put it in, and then take that out within 15 days or 5 days or whatever okay. That is.
Since it is a temporary structure, and just ask staff, it would be acceptable for 1E to remove removal of the ramp within 15 days, all your other language, within 15 days of the completion of Phase 3, and that the permit authorizes reinstallation for the ramp for the express purpose of removal of the groundwater monitoring wells with the ramp to again be removed within 15 days of the completion of that task.
Well, if it's removed within 15 days of completion of Phase 3, my understanding is that could be a year after it was originally installed, because they're going to be monitoring those wells throughout the year, monitoring and pumping, and that's what Phase 3 is. Well,
Phase 3 says complete soil borings along the proposed pipeline and other project elements. Phase 3 will also include test pumping from the monitoring wells, but does that continue over a course of a year?
The monitoring wells get left in place for approximately a year period, and during that time, it's a technician that's just going to walk down there probably with a shovel over his shoulder and dig the thing out, dip in, take some water samples, measure the level, and that
Will they be pumped throughout that year?
It's sample pumping, so it's not pumping a large discharge, but there's going to be probably some sample pumping, some baling of the water to make sure he has a good adequate sample.
So Phase 3 lasts for a year.
Well,
you don't intend to leave the ramp there, correct?
Well, right, we do not intend to leave the ramp there after we do our initial pump test, which is what we interpreted as part of Phase 3.
Okay, well then the language needs to reflect. Okay.
Yes. So removed within 15 days after the pump test specified in 1C. And
sounds like we need a new F to F. allow them, if required, to put in some sort of ramp to take out the...
if the applicant's willing, you could put it just a...
Could we?
All activities must be complete within 2 years.
Completed within 2 years?
Okay.
We might be micromanaging this.
Oh, you think so?
You know, that's our job.
I disagree.
Let's move on that. We had one other... we have the trash pickup. We have the installation and deinstallation of ramps and wells. And what was the other?
If I could just add a little suggestion I just heard, and that is on that two-year time frame that we're talking about, that's provided we have all the other permits in place. So we don't want to run out of time because we're dealing with some other permit that might be concurrent with that.
Okay. I think the final one was with regard to something Commissioner Christie brought up about the filling of the holes. And if you can refer to that condition, I couldn't find the specific condition.
I couldn't.
Oh, you know, it may have been, the description I think was probably in the neg deck that talked about the backfilling with the concrete and the bentonite slurry.
So perhaps we could do,
I'm sorry, I mean,
you're not,
flag it.
I believe that's covered by state law, and so I.
Right, the conditions wouldn't. You wouldn't need to revise the conditions to provide that flexibility that you were hoping to provide.
So they could still, if it turned out that it was geologically feasible, to just let the holes sort of fill themselves. They wouldn't be required to do the bentonite
concrete
slurry.
What they describe in the environmental document is the worst case scenario.
Okay.
So. Okay.
Okay. Do we have specific? So I think at that point we're just going to let that happen as a matter of state law, within your other permits. And so the question is, do we have specific language for new 1E and new 1F that we could read for the record?
Sure. 1E would be what I read into the record before: removal of the temporary ramp, temporary anchorages, and the parking area returned to its pre-construction state shall occur within 15 days of the pump test specified in Phase 3. Mm-hmm. And F would be reinstallation of the ramp is authorized to allow removal of groundwater monitoring wells, and such ramp shall be removed within 15 days of completion of the removal of the groundwater monitoring wells. Mm-hmm. And then I believe another condition was brought up, that all activities on the site shall be completed within 2 years of issuance of any permits from State Parks, Coastal Commission, U.S. Fish and Wildlife.
Okay, and that would occur in what?
Yada, yada.
That being a technical term.
Applicable permits. Right.
And that would be a modification of a condition, or?
I think that would probably be a brand new condition, and you could actually put it at the very end because of the timing condition.
Okay, so that would then be a new condition 38.
38.
All right. With that, and with no objection from my colleagues, I will go ahead and move approval of development plan, coastal development permit, DRC 2004-00142, based on the findings in Exhibit A and the conditions listed in Exhibit B as modified with new conditions 1E and 1F as read into the record, and new condition 38 as read into the record.
And also modification of condition 15 on the daily trash removal.
And the modification of condition 15 as to trash removal read into the record.
Second.
How about it? We need to adopt the mitigated, the MND.
We're just considering.
We did that.
Oh, okay.
CSD did the heavy lifting on that.
Okay. All right. It's been moved and seconded. Any more discussion? If not, maybe we have.
I actually am not going to be supporting the motion, and just for the record, I'd like to state why. I'm not fundamentally opposed to the concept of a desal facility that uses beach wells for, as opposed to ocean water intake, which I think is very clear what this project is leading to. But I am concerned that we haven't fully mitigated the impacts to public access as required by our CZLUO. And I'm also not convinced that we know everything we need to know about the potential impacts to threatened and endangered species, particularly the tidewater goby, which is in the lagoon, which is directly adjacent to where these activities are going to be taking place, and where their eggs are, which may also be adversely affected by the activities. And in the absence of evidence to the contrary, I think it's incumbent upon us to exercise the precautionary principle here. And until it can be demonstrated that these species won't be affected, we have to assume that they could be. So I can't make the findings required under CEQA or under our own CZLUO. I won't be supporting the motion.
May we have a roll call, please?
It's across the alley to the north. And vehicle dealers and auto body shops are located across the street to the south in the commercial service land use category. The next, this is a site plan showing the proposed used car lot facility. These next series of pictures show the area and the surrounding properties. This is the project site with the structures that are located existing on the project site. Here's the restaurant next door. There's a medical office here and a grocery store next door. Here are the uses across the street in the commercial service land use category. Typically, uses related to auto services. And then you can see the residential multifamily units behind the site. The land use ordinance section allows vehicle dealerships within the central business district, provided that all vehicles are stored, displaced, and serviced entirely within the building. And that requirement is because central business districts provide for a concentration of businesses and facilities that support pedestrian activity. Central business districts are typically thought of the downtown areas of places. The placement of buildings directly on a sidewalk is one of the key components of encouraging this type of activity, and it's also key to preventing the incompatibility of uses that may occur with things such as the auto dealership. Staff informed the applicant several times before submittal that an outdoor used car lot would not be allowed in this area, and that while the Planning Commission had the authority to waive this requirement, that staff would not be supportive. In order to approve the request for modification, your commission needs to make findings that identify the specific conditions of the site that make this requirement unnecessary. The commission needs to identify the standard being modified and find that the project meets all mandatory findings for approval of conditional use permits. One of the mandatory findings is that the project will not be inconsistent with the character of the immediate neighborhood or contrary to orderly development. This graphic highlights the land use categories. The commercial retail category is right here. It's located between the multifamily land use category, which is shown in brown, and the commercial service land use category, which is shown in purple. The commercial retail land use category really provides a buffer area between these two land use categories. It provides a buffer area between the commercial service uses and the residential multifamily development. Allowing an outdoor used car dealership, similar to the ones across the street, effectively removes this buffer area and extends commercial service land uses so that are between and adjacent to commercial retail and residential uses. Therefore, the proposed project does not provide for orderly development. Another mandatory finding is that the project is consistent with the general plan. Framework for planning describes the purpose and intended character of land use categories. And the purpose of central business district areas are to provide for centralized area for stores, offices, and service establishments needed to serve neighborhood needs and encourage pedestrian circulation. As I described earlier, the placement of buildings directly on the sidewalk is one of the key components of providing this encouraging this pedestrian shopping experience. And this arrangement of buildings generates a large volume of pedestrian traffic and provides for window displays and such that you normally associate with downtown areas. Again, providing these uses indoors also prevents the incompatibilities that may occur with neighboring uses. Also part of the general plan is the Oceano Specific Plan, which provides an overall framework and vision for translating the specific community values into standards and guidelines. The Oceano Specific Plan identifies this area's lack of human scale and cohesiveness of a typical downtown as its barriers to success. The specific plan contains a program for future development of this area in compliance with the downtown conceptual plan, and I put that graphic up on the screen. As you can see from that graphic, for this particular site, it shows buildings located directly on the sidewalk. The specific plan also provides guidelines related to orientation of design and buildings in this downtown area. In general, the guidelines call for, again, the placement of buildings on the front property line. It calls for lighting that complements the pedestrian experience and complements the building design. It calls for the design of all landscaping to be of professional quality and be a major component of any parking area. Expansive paved areas are to be avoided. And chain link fencing is not a preferred fencing material, and screening between a commercial service and residential use should be a solid masonry wall. And finally, signing should be carefully provided. Based on the information, the project is not consistent with the Oceano specific plan. Finally, there are not conditions of the site or vicinity that make this standard that requires dealerships to be located indoors unnecessary, because the site is located between a restaurant and medical office and adjacent to multifamily residences. Locating vehicles stored, displayed, and serviced indoors is necessary to prevent incompatibilities with these adjacent uses and to create an area which encourages pedestrian activity consistent with the general plan. Staff recommends denial of the requested modification based on the findings in Exhibit A. This concludes my presentation.
Since this is in my district, I looked at it and went down and actually walked on the street. Could you put your zoning map back up, the first one that you showed? Okay, this street, Sienica, is Highway 1. So I went down and walked the street to see how I feel if I would want to shop there. And the problem I had, there's a lot of truck traffic on that road. It's a busy street, and I'm really questioning whether it's conducive to pedestrian shopping. I get my hair cut up here at Mario's on that next street up, and where the post office is and everything. And a street like that is much more conducive, I think, to pedestrian shopping because the traffic is not there like it is on Highway 1, and it's they're not going near as fast. People come through there lickety split because you don't have to stop. So the traffic has not been calmed. It's fast, and I really question what you're trying to do here because I think it's going to be tough to do, especially from what I observed when I walked the street.
And that's really one of the reasons for the specific plan, and I think that the community identified in that specific plan as that this lack of human scale and cohesiveness is one of the barriers to success for this area. And the guidelines and the programs and the standards put into that plan were intended to bring about that change and really create this as the downtown and central business district area.
Yeah, but now the advisory council wants this, so has there been a change in the feeling of the community?
Well, the development of the community plan is typically much more involved in the community. There's numerous town hall meetings. It's over years' time. There's a lot of involvement from a broad spectrum of the community that may not have been in attendance to the advisory council meeting that looked at this specific project.
Okay. Well, that's my comments to this point. So, any others?
You're saying in response to Chairman Melskow's concerns that this would be the kind of the first project to bring in that human scale that is obviously planned for a longer term?
Right. If you look at some of the neighboring businesses, you can see that when these were developed, they weren't developed close to the street, or they at this time wouldn't be considered consistent with the Oceano specific plan. And that's what we, through the process of developing that specific plan, heard that the community didn't want to see any more of this, that they wanted to change the way that this street is developed.
And I presume and really know that, you know, that street was a busy street at that time too, but that still the community wanted that, what you showed us on the screen here a few minutes
right.
ago?
Right, and that specific plan was officially adopted in 2004.
Right, thank you.
After I turn my mic on, if we go back to your zoning, your land use category map, the commercial retail outlined in red, is that the extent of the central business district? Are those one and the same?
Pretty much the central business district line is actually this dotted line that there's just a little discrepancy right there.
Okay. And in general, right now, the development within that area is what? Fully developed, partially developed?
Partially developed or underdeveloped. You can see from some of the neighboring pictures that there's quite a bit of area that could be
and actually there seems to be some residential use scattered in there as well, possibly.
Yes.
I don't know that within the commercial area, but with the residential land use category so close, it's in close proximity.
And the Oceano specific plan certified by the Board of Supervisors, because this is inland, in April of 2004. Do you have any history on the run-up to that? It was, as you say, a multi-year process. It was at least under under consideration for a couple years prior to its certification, I would guess.
Right. I wasn't involved in that, but in talking...
I've been a contractor. I was a contractor for over 20 years. We've won... My company, D&B Construction, has won 3 beautification awards in San Luis Obispo for the city of San Luis, rebuilding old Victorian homes. We plan on using the same discretion on this site here to make this something people want to come to. The landscape plan and the development is only going to beautify this area, in my opinion. It's not going to impact the specific plan in the central core area because we're doing nothing there that will ever hurt it. If some multimillionaire Donald Trump wanted to come in and put in a big shopping center there, there's nothing there that can't be removed. We're not adding new structures. We're strictly repairing the structures that are there and try to beautify the area. As for the solid fencing, I talked to the Sheriff's Department. You saw I was at the last Oceano Advisory Board meeting, and they totally support this project. I was there, and the fact was brought up about the chain-link fencing. It's not chain-link fencing, it's screening. It's a chain-link fence with slats in it with the appropriate landscaping to try to beautify the area. I talked to the Sheriff's Department down there, and they are completely opposed to any solid fencing in that area. And our plans also call for lighting within the area, and they're supportive of that because they want to be able to look onto the property and see what's going on and have more visible contact. They're totally against any type of solid fencing in that area. This is just the starting of the permit process. We still have to get permits from DMV. They have to actually come on site and prove it. We have the new laws coming on the 3-day cooling off. I just went to conferences on that. So we have the state franchise board that has to approve this. This is a multi-phase project. It's not just going to happen overnight. As for my character, I've won the Daimler Chrysler Manager of Distinction Award for the last 3 years, which out of the entire 250 dealerships, only 5 of us were appointed that. So I thought I'm coming in this with a lot of ethics and treating people properly. I know the word used car lot has a bad rap a lot of times. The dealership I'm working at right now, we are highly recommended and supportive. I won't keep you forever, but those are my views and my hopes for this area.
Any questions?
Yeah. When you said you're working at one, are you in management?
Yes, I'm in management. I'm in sales and finance management. It's a small dealership, and I basically do everything.
And where is this?
In Paso Robles.
Which one?
Jerry Renault Chrysler Dodge.
Okay. Thank you.
And I was going to bring up another point. It's all right.
Mm-hmm. Any other?
Oh, we're not going to do any on-site repairs to the vehicles. This is commercial retail. We're not going to do services. We're not going to change oil. We're not going to change tire. That, I've already talked to all the community people around there. There's tire stores. There's, you know, service stations. There's all sorts of people that want our work. We're basically going to be a commercial retail business.
I noticed across the street they had mostly had a body shop and they had...
Right, and we're going to use all of those. And we don't even want to be thought of as like the one across the street with the flags and the balloons and the chain link fence. We don't want to look like a prison. We want to actually invite people into the property. And like I said, what we're doing now, 10 years from now, I might say, I don't want to do the car business anymore. I want to put a Starbucks up. That would work, or a Jamba Juice. But as you pointed out, the traffic condition there, I would not walk a child down that street when you know that the speed limit there is 40 or something. And it's a highway. It's Highway 1.
Yeah, it's 45.
Right. And I wouldn't be walking up and down the street. Now, down towards the melodrama, I can see that as being, I would love to have something down there and develop it because that will be a shopping area for people.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Thank you. You'll have a chance to address any concerns that are brought up at the end. I have several speaker slips. First one is Bill Book. All I can read is B-O-O-K something. I'm sorry. And next will be Donald Peterman.
I apologize. I have a horrible handwriting.
Okay.
My name's Bill Bookout. I own Oceano Nursery. I developed my nursery, Oceano Nursery, 6 years ago in 2000, around July 4th. I have a dream for Oceano. I'm in a vision for Oceano, the future of Oceano. That's why I'm in Oceano. This project is the is part of the future of Oceano. It works great for the site. As you saw from the picture of the site, you saw a curb. You saw no sidewalk behind the curb. You saw weeds. You saw a fence that's kind of ugly in the front. The whole community of Oceano, the business area down there, is pretty much represented of this. You saw the store next door with Community Health Center. That the business will improve the appearance of the part of Oceano where it will be located. It will provide a service to residents because many Oceano residents purchase used cars rather than new ones. In addition, people who stop at the lot to look at cars probably more likely than other visitors on Highway 1 to patronize Oceano businesses. There's been no businesses developed in Oceano in the last 6 years on property other than my nursery. I welcome new businesses, and this business will be a great benefit to our community of Oceano. We're a growing community. We're kind of like the stepchild of the county. We need help. This business will ensure us that help. And I thank you. If there's any questions.
All right. Thank you. Next is Mr. Donald Peterman.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Commissioners. I have 3 points that I'd like to make. First of all,
State your name, please.
I'm sorry. My name is Donald Peterman. Mm-hmm. The first point I'd like to make is that the lot that is being proposed, to give you an idea of scope, is something that is anticipated, if a great job is done, will sell 30 cars a month. 30 cars a month, if you look at national industry standards, means that they have to draw in approximately 150 customers per month. That averages out only to 5 customers per day and about 3 test drives per day. My point on this is it will have minimal impact of the traffic there on Highway 1. And that brings me to my next point, which is the same one that you made, sir. When you look at the central core or the core business district, and what they were trying to attain was to provide a window shopping pedestrian environment. The site for this project is at the edge of that central business district. It's not in the heart of it. It's basically on the perimeter. And across the street is the repair facilities. And there is a lot of traffic there. It's just not conducive to pedestrian business. And to the argument that automobile dealerships aren't pedestrian or window shopping environments, I would invite you to go down and take a look at car dealerships, especially when they're closed. You see lots of people milling around looking at cars and doing window shopping in that environment. And much more so than the two neighboring businesses, which is a doctor's office and a grocery store. I applaud them. They've got very good-looking businesses there with the palm trees. It's respectful, it's clean, it's a step up for the community. That's not a window shopping environment, nevertheless. And I'd like to also draw your attention back to the letter that Mr. Book outread from the Oceano Advisory Commission, that this is the type of business that they're looking for, and they feel it will provide the window shopping environment. And my last note is just, if you're not aware, the taxes that car dealerships drive in, 30 cars, selling 30 cars a month at an average price of $8,000 to $10,000 or $12,000 generates a substantial tax base for the community. I think this would be a good thing for Oceano, and we pray for your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Is there anyone else? Apparently not. Thank you. Anyone else wish to speak? If not, any closing remarks, sir? Okay, thank you, and then I'll bring it back to the commission.
One question of staff. Just looking at the specific plan, it was certified by the Coastal Commission in April of 2004. The quotations in the staff report are Title 22, Inland LUO. Or am I getting this wrong?
Somewhere? Right. There's a portion of the specific plan that does cover is within the coastal Act boundary and a portion that was inland. The plan itself was adopted in its entirety for the inland areas, I believe a year and a half in advance of the Coastal Commission, then approving it for the coastal portions of Oceano. Oceano is split partially coastal, partially inland.
Okay, and in this instance, the coastal zone is very thin in Oceano then.
Right.
As in Cayucas, okay.
And in this case, this particular property is not within the coastal zone.
Okay. I just, if it's okay.
Okay, go ahead.
I think in a way it's kind of unfortunate. We don't have a lot of latitude, as I understand, the adoption of the specific plan and the allowed uses and that type of thing. But then, and I certainly refer to our chairman, who's much more familiar if he gets his hair cut there. I mean, on a street that has a posted speed limit of 45, which then would lead anyone to recognize that the vehicle...
On the Central Coast here, we often have downtowns that are on highways. I think 227 goes through Royal Grande, Highway 1 goes through San Luis Obispo. And if my understanding of traffic speeds, I don't know all the details, but I believe that posted speed limits are oftentimes related to the uses on that street. For example, I know in Cambria, oftentimes people want to get speeds reduced, but it's dependent on how many residences or how many commercial businesses are actually there. So as this area develops, that posted speed limit, while it is appropriate today, may be reduced as these types of businesses go in. So I don't think the speed is, even though now it's posted at something, should be thought of as in perpetuity.
Don't we have to make overriding, we have to have some kind of overriding finding, though? I mean, in order to, I mean, the findings are fairly specific mm-hmm. as to what we can do.
They're on right. Your page 2-2, about halfway down in the italics. So you would need to find that the waiver, there's something about the specific site or vicinity that makes the standard unnecessary or ineffective. And then you would also have to continue to make all the normal findings you make,
right.
The consistent with the area, that the street is adequate, those kinds of findings.
Let me ask a related question. I heard the applicant say that he didn't plan to do any servicing there, which seems to me that that's what put the auto dealerships in a commercial service zone. But if you're just not doing any of that, his argument that this is a commercial retail, why wouldn't this be allowed in the commercial retail?
It would be, as long as all vehicles for sale are stored, displayed, and serviced entirely within a building.
Right.
That's the requirement for a central business district. In fact, if this commercial retail were not in a commercial business, or a central business district, this standard would not apply. It's only that this is commercial retail and in a CBD that this standard then applies.
Okay, let me explore another one. If we found that because of the nature of this community today, that this would be okay for a certain length of time, say 10 years?
One issue I know that I've discussed with our enforcement division about that is that it's virtually impossible to get established businesses to leave, if even with a time limit. If people don't do it voluntarily, it's up to... court action on that, and typically we have not been able to pursue that. So from the enforcement division, that's an ineffective requirement.
Okay, but how about from a looking at what's on the ground today, and I understand where the specific plan is going, but this appears to be the first one to get us there. And if we allowed it to go in for 10 years and then relooked at it?
I'm not upfront opposed to that kind of concept, but let me approach this a little differently with a plea for good planning. And I think the application of good planning sometimes results in us having to make decisions that may seem arbitrary or otherwise unpleasurable. But I look at I'd like to go back to the nature of the Oceano specific plan, which was written as a means of developing the community of Oceano, who through meetings and expressions of community will came up with the idea that they wanted a central business district to be of a certain sort, and presumably in laying out the specifics of the specific plan, namely where commercial retail is going to go, where commercial service is going to go, there was some analysis of the future growth of the community and what we might envision as Oceano becoming. And the principles, there are a couple principles, I think, of good planning there, and one of them is that we need to set aside land with a certain land use category or zoning to accomplish certain goals, which would be, it sounds to me, mostly like resident-serving uses, the stores, the medical facilities, the restaurants, the things that we normally find in commercial retail. And that elsewhere in the community, there's industrially zoned land, there's commercial service zoned land, where uses such as open-use car lots could go. And I have no problem. Mr. Freeman seems like a man of good character and some business skill, and I have nothing against used car lots. But I think in this instance, I think we have to honor the efforts that went into the creation of the Oceano-specific plan, even though it might...
None of those would you walk and shop to. I don't think you would drive to all of these. So,
well, let me make a couple of observations on that. The pedestrian accessibility of a particular business district depends, I think, mostly on curb, gutter, and sidewalk. You know, proper streetscaping, which doesn't seem to be in place in this part of Oceano. I think with a proper sidewalk, you get a very different level of pedestrian accessibility. I think the other thing about planning, which is what we do here, is to take the longer view. And whereas in the short term, this may make sense as a business opportunity within Oceano, and that's why I am open to considering Commissioner Rose's concept of a time-limited opportunity here. I tend to agree with staff that the practical considerations of that are difficult to overcome. So I think in dealing with the things that are in our general plan and honoring the standards in our land use ordinance, we have to take the long view and leave that land as it is for an opportunity, someone who wants to come along with an opportunity to develop something that's at this point consistent with the plan.
Could staff put the zoning map back up for us, or for me? Thanks.
Well, while we're all thinking out loud, Commissioner Gibson is absolutely right. Did you have something to say?
No.
Or you just wanted to look at it?
No, I did. I wanted to refresh my mind.
Okay, I was waiting, but while I'm still waiting, I'll address what Commissioner Gibson had said, and he's absolutely right. I mean, we've got to look at the long haul, and it appears like we have two conflicting viewpoints of community vision. We have the Oceano-specific plan, and we have a few residents who came down here today, and we have the existing advisory group. And, you know, so I got to weigh the two of them, and I really got to give more weight to the Pacific plan because I know the history they went through, endless meetings on dark and stormy nights that people came to and had weighed through planning commission hearings and board of supervisors hearings and eventually came and said, this is our goal, this is where we want to be. And that's the one I really have to respect, not that I'm disrespecting the existing advisory group or right. The residents who come down here, I think staff is absolutely right. The chances of getting rid of the thing after 10 years are slim. Yeah. We can't even get rid of a car lot in Templeton that doesn't have any permit. Yeah. Never had one.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me just add my respect for the advisory council as well. For, you know, many years sitting in advisory council meetings, I appreciate the goodwill that people bring to that process for the most part, and it is not lightly
that my view, that I choose my view differently from the unanimous opinion of this advisory council. I understand that I have considered that, and I just think that we come here for the bigger picture perspective and the precedent and the nature of applying the county's planning process.
Well, and I'd just like to add to that that I might be more sympathetic to the project if we were dealing with a community plan that was, you know, years out of date, that had been prepared in the 1980s or, you know, some like some communities are laboring under. But this was just certified by the Board of Supervisors in 2004. So this is a very current reflection of the direction that Oceano has stated it would like to go in as a community. And I would just offer, this is not unlike a situation in the 5th District where Highway 58 runs through the town of Santa Margarita, which does have a used car lot on it, but it also has a lot of pedestrian-oriented antique shops. There's great little restaurants and coffee shops springing up, and yet it's a very busy highway, particularly in the summer months. And as these types of businesses develop, the incremental result is that traffic is slowing down, people are getting more pedestrian-oriented, and there is more discussion about how to make other improvements to further that sort of progress. So I would just ask for maybe a flip in the perspective. Rather than looking at this area and saying, you know, traffic is really fast on Cienega and there's no place for people to shop, and so it doesn't make sense to have that be our business district, let's move the business district. If you flip that perspective around and say, well, you know, there's traffic and there's no places for people to shop, so let's start to change that. That's what planning is all about. That's what gets us from where we are to where we want to be. And because we have a very recent and current expression of where we want to be, or we being the greater we, specifically the community of Oceano, I think that with, you know, obviously all due respect and consideration of the advisory council and individual members of the public, we need to be looking at these projects and saying, are they moving us toward...
Any more discussion?
Speaking to the motion, I'm reluctant to support it, but I will, based on these two conflicting visions of the community, and I got to add the stronger weight to the specific plan.
Yeah. I concur with Commissioner Rose's sentiments on this.
That's why I made the motion.
Is that it? So, roll call, please.
Commissioner Rapa?
Yes.
Commissioner Gibson?
Yes.
Commissioner Christie?
Yes.
Commissioner Rose?
Yes.
Chairman Melskow?
Yes.
Yeah.
Hey, we don't want to pay overtime here.
Ooh.
Do we get a rebate if we break 4 minutes early?
Well, no, we had this discussion about not going over.
I know, that's what I'm saying. Do we get a rebate?
Yeah.
Well, can we bank this 5 minutes? I think it's so close to 12 that rather than get into the next item that we'll go ahead and break for lunch and reconvene here at 1:30. Good afternoon. We will reconvene the San Luis Obispo County Planning Commission. There it goes. All right. Next will be item number 3. Is that correct?
Yep.
May we have it announced, please?
Hearing to consider a request by the County of San Luis Obispo to amend sections of the Land Use Ordinance Title 22 of the County Code and amend sections of the Coastal Zone Land Use Ordinance Title 23. County file number LRP 2005-00009A and B, Supervisorial District All, Ted Bench, Project Manager.
Thank you, and good afternoon. Mm-hmm. I'd like to go to the PowerPoint up on the screen overhead.
There it is.
There we go. Okay, thank you. The item in front of us is a proposal to amend the county's land use ordinance to include a mobile home park and condominium conversion ordinance. And this is actually part of a three-part program that's laid out in the county's housing element on affordable housing. And as you can see on the screen, we have three packages. The first package would be ordinances regarding retention of existing affordable housing. Second package is revising affordable housing standards. And the third package would be new ordinances to require new affordable housing. Today we're talking about package number one, which, again, is about proposed ordinances for condominium and mobile home park conversions. At your next hearing on July 13th, you'll also be asked to consider a package on secondary dwelling ordinances. So first I'm going to start off with condominium conversions. We've reviewed the ordinances throughout the state, and what we found is that most jurisdictions have condominium conversion ordinances. Some are really strict, requiring insulation of interior walls to buffer noise, no loss of affordable units, 1 to 3 months of rental assistance, and prohibiting condo conversions if the vacancy rate is below 5% in that community. What we're proposing in the package that's attached to your staff report is an ordinance for condo conversions that would require that a new proposal to convert an apartment building into a condominium would require a conditional use permit that in effect for that community today, and that the developer provide a one-year guarantee on the buildings and the road and the landscape. A tenant information package would be required that inform the tenant that they have a 180-day rent termination period that starts on the day that the project receives tentative approval. That there would be, the tenant is protected from unjust evictions or rent increase, and again that they have an option to buy their unit. Also, that relocation assistance would be provided in the amount of 2 times what the rent of that existing unit is that the tenant lives in. Finally, our county is not proposing that there be a prohibition against condo conversions if the vacancy rate is below 5%, because on an average, the vacancy rate is always below 5% in our county. Only Atascadero currently has a vacancy rate of about 8%, and that fluctuates year to year. So instead, we looked at example that San Luis Obispo City has adopted, and their ordinance requires that the number of condo conversion be limited to 50% of the rental units that were built in the previous year. And that would be, we suggest that as the method in which the county could prevent a flood of condo conversions at any one point in time. The condo conversions would be limited to the number of rental units that are coming online in any given two-year period. That way the county's assured that it will have a supply of rental units and not fear the loss of the existing stock of rental units at any given point. I guess I should stop right there and ask if there are any questions about the proposed condominium conversion ordinance. I would be happy to answer them.
I have a question that'll reappear in the mobile home park conversion ordinance as well. We're proposing that a condo conversion get a conditional use permit. And my overall question has to do with the nature and use of the impact report. And, you know, it comes down to this. If we see impacts identified, according to the various bits of data that would be part of that, is that to be taken into consideration in approving or not approving the conditional use permit? And if it is, then we might want to talk about exactly what standards, you know, we're going to gauge that impact report against.
The impact report is more of an educational tool for the decision makers to inform them as to who would be affected by the project. It mm-hmm. doesn't necessarily result in conditions, although it would be up if the decision makers, after they've read the impact report, if they feel compelled to make conditions on a project, they're certainly able to. But the impact report itself is simply an educational tool.
Mm-hmm.
It's not.
It's in the manner of an environmental impact report, and I'd be interested in eventually in county councils. Consideration of what sorts of things, you know, if we were to want the power to put conditions on condo conversions in this case, based on the results of an impact report, what sorts of things would we have to have in the ordinance to make that a direct and transparent kind of process? That, again, we'll talk about this more, I'm sure, as we go along.
Thank you.
Well, I have a couple questions. This all comes to us under affordable housing. Did I miss it, or is there information that talks about kind of a, quote, an average rent? So that we can, because we're sort of trying to equate the unit to the cost, to the affordableness of what's being converted or not converted or
sure.
impacted or...
The proposed ordinance with the impact report, that impact report would be, as it's presented to you today, would require that you know, or that you, the decision maker, know who would be displaced, what their rent is right now, and then the next...
That rents... which I think they are, but I'm not sure, rents would fall in the affordable category.
Okay.
Then rental property would be, quote, affordable housing, which is what this whole thing is supposed to be. I mean, that's the premise under which we're looking at these.
Let me look at it a different way. This ordinance does not propose in any way to protect existing, It would simply let you know how many of the units are occupied by low or very low or wealthy tenants. It wouldn't prevent a condo conversion simply because of the income level of who lives there. It really it does not address or restrict condominiums to... I guess another way of saying it is that some jurisdictions actually prohibit this condo conversions where low-income units would be lost. A one-to-one replacement is required in the city of San Luis Obispo, for example. And this ordinance is not doing that. This ordinance is simply, through the impact report, identifying which units are occupied by low or very low-income individuals and also allowing the decision-maker to know what the vacancy rate is throughout the rest of the community as well, but it's not putting on any requirements about replacing or protecting existing affordable units.
Okay, so through that identifying of affordable units, how will those be retained?
This ordinance would not do that. I appreciate that other jurisdictions do have an ordinance in a place that does that, but we're not proposing that. We're proposing something that's more modest, if you will.
Isn't this entire effort being taken up under the auspices of complying with the county's adopted housing element? I mean, isn't this part of the affordable housing program? Isn't that why we're here today?
Yes, and if I could add to that, Dana Lilly with the planning staff, as Ted said, the housing element has a lot of programs. Some are aimed at maintaining some of the stock we have, some of which is affordable, and some of the programs relate to new housing development down the road. We're not at that point yet. Because there's a concern about maintaining some rental housing stock in the county, of which apartments are an important part, we looked at should the county have a clearer ordinance provisions that address the loss of rental stock through converting to condominiums. We haven't had an excessive number of apartments converted to condominiums. We have had increased interest by property owners and potential property owners in it. So have the cities. So our conclusion was we do need better provisions in the ordinance. Now, affordability of those units that are converted is a slightly different matter, and is one your commission will get to bite on a bit further next spring when we bring to you an proposed inclusionary housing ordinance. Because a condo conversion itself is a subdivision of property into legal condominium lots. And it may be that the county should extend to condominium maps the provisions of inclusionary housing and say either some percent should be affordable or those that were affordable before should be affordable. I won't, you know, predispose how that's going to end up, but that's how we'll get to more of the affordability.
Yeah.
But this is really just intended to maintain rental stock, and if there's continues to be a supply of rental stock, it will probably, through market forces, help maintain some affordable rental housing stock.
But, Mr. Lilly, your comments would imply that the only mechanism for providing affordable housing would be through the inclusionary housing ordinance, and yet we've heard many, many times that the inclusionary housing ordinance is only one of many options and programs under which to obtain and protect affordable housing. So I look at this ordinance, it's sort of a clean slate, if you will. We could look at this ordinance through the perspective of simply providing guidelines for condominium conversions, period. Or we could look at this ordinance as yet one of many other opportunities, some of which have not come to us yet, to protect and provide affordable housing. Now, I understand that the way it's currently written, it does not protect or provide affordable housing. But I think we need to acknowledge that we could make changes to the ordinance so that it does protect and provide affordable housing, correct?
But we first have to know, is this housing stock, quote, affordable? And we have lots of statistics in here, but we don't have anything on an average rent or, I mean, we have where we show, you know, what certain other cities have done. I'm not trying to be...
In running its Section 8 rental assistance program, tells us they're having no problem finding landowners who are willing to rent under Section 8 because the rental market is actually soft for them.
So,
it seems counterintuitive, but the rents have not become as serious a problem as sales.
So,
nevertheless, it's healthy to have some rental stock.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
So I'm wondering if we might be able to set some context for this ordinance. I mean, it seems what I get out of this initial flurry is perhaps a clear statement of intent. And what I was looking at is this ordinance comes forward from policies, presumably, in the housing element. So it would be helpful
to start by knowing what policies this ordinance is meant to implement, what assumptions we're working under. And the assumption that we're working under seems to be that rental stock is more affordable than housing stock for purchase. So if this ordinance comes forward on the basis of that assumption, then maybe we should quite rightfully consider whether the ordinance should speak explicitly to maintaining a certain level of affordability.
Thank you, Commissioner Gibson. Again, Dana Lilly, that is why we bring this to you in this context. The housing element program that was adopted by the board says the county will review existing ordinances and, if necessary, prepare an ordinance addressing proposals to convert mobile home parks, and we went on to take that to mean also condominium conversions, and then look at the impacts of those. It didn't actually direct us to require affordable housing as an inclusionary. So we took that to mean direction from the board through the housing element that this looks at the impacts.
On what? That's the key.
On mobile home park conversions or condo conversions, and there's a separate program that talks about requiring affordable housing. So we took that to mean we were directed to separate those two into different efforts.
Okay, but it could equally be read that the board directed to look at an ordinance regarding mobile home park conversions and condo conversions as to those conversions' impact on the affordability of housing in San Luis Obispo County.
Okay.
So if I understand that right, then I think that this condo conversion ordinance, which we're considering right now, should have some explicit reference to the goal of protecting affordability, and that's really why I was asking about the impact report.
It's okay. Not a question of the impact on the conversion. It's a question of the conversion's impact on the community. That's really where the impact happens.
Well, I think it's twofold. I think it's an impact on the community, but I also think that because this is a conversion in the first offer and all goes to the existing residents, and I happen to know that the Housing Authority is having some difficulty in that some of those tenants who are now to become homeowners cannot afford to become homeowners. Mm-hmm. So even when it's the Housing Authority doing it, I don't know the answer to this, but at least if we can start with the premise that somehow this all has to relate to the affordableness of the conversion, I think it would be helpful. And I appreciate my colleague over here remembering all these statistical facts. I didn't.
All right. To take off on what Commissioner Gibson was saying, I went and looked at the next project, which has a negative declaration in it, and I'm saying, okay, let's just say we had a conversion of a 100-unit apartment complex to condos. Let's fill out the environmental checklist, and I got the population and housing, and I didn't see anything that would alert one to the fact that affordability, we may lose a bunch of affordable units here because most likely the people who are now paying $1,000 a month won't be able to pay the $2,000 a month for the condo payment. So
I think he's talking about a different impact report. Is that what I heard?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
No. When the if tomorrow we had a application for a 100-unit apartment complex to a condo, they'd have to get a
they have to have an environmental determination and an impact report as discussed here. Is that
well? If we did it tomorrow, they'd have to have the they'd have to get a CUP, which would generate an environmental document, which would not tell us whether affordable housing is going to be improved or not. Am I correct on that?
You're correct. This
so how have what you've done is how are we going to fix that?
This proposed ordinance would require that, along with this conditional use permit application, that an impact report be provided, and that's an impact report that just describes the impact on the residents and the community.
For consistency, it would seem to me that this condo conversion ordinance would have to have provisions in it that would result in the conversion in an ideal case, being neutral as to affordability, whether it's rent or own. You could go through and assess the rents charged before conversion. You could assess the income level of the people who occupy the apartment complex, which is what I was understanding that basically this was going on. And then if we are bringing forward this ordinance in the fulfillment of a couple of policy goals of the county, one is to not to lose rental housing, and the second is not to lose affordability, which are related but not exactly the same, then shouldn't this ordinance speak directly toward achieving those goals?
Agreed.
I believe that it should, and I think one of the obvious ways to get there is if we do decide that condominium conversions are a desirable way to go, which we don't necessarily have to come to that conclusion. We could do what other communities have done and simply prohibit them. But if we do go in that direction, it seems to me that one of the most direct ways to assure that affordability is maintained is to require that the condominiums be deed restricted so that they are available for purchase by individuals in the low to moderate or whatever spectrum we select. But that's the only way to ensure that fee ownership units are affordable. The market forces will never make that guarantee. That leads me to another question of staff. This point was made during our previous workshop. There were a lot of really good comments that were made by the public and some very substantive discussion by the commission. I know that some of us weighed in on the question of the amount of the relocation assistance, whether or not that was adequate, and a number of other issues. Were any of those comments that were made during that workshop, are any of those comments reflected in any revisions? Because we had this ordinance before us then. Was this ordinance revised in any way to reflect any of those comments that were made at the workshop?
There weren't any substantial changes to the text, but as a result of that workshop, staff went out and checked what the level of activity in the surrounding communities, and in the staff report you can see that. It's very amazing, I think, that many communities have very few applications for condo conversions, yet Atascadero has had so many applications again, there weren't any substantial changes to the text itself, but there was more research done on staff part to answer the questions that came up at the workshop.
Well, and I would like to attest to the fact that it may not be a significant trend in the county as a whole yet, but statewide, it is absolutely a significant trend, and I think it's only a matter of time before it becomes a really common issue in San Luis Obispo County. And so I want to commend staff for getting in front of the curve to addressing it before it becomes a problem. And I also want to urge others in the audience not to assume that, because it's not a problem now, it won't ever be, and therefore we don't really need to address it, because we absolutely do. It's coming.
Okay, can we continue?
I had one minor point here on page 314. You're talking about the tenant information package, and at the very bottom we're talking about their rent increases not exceeding the rate of increase, the consumer price index for the San Luis Obispo area. Is there one? A published one somewhere? Where would...
I don't know.
Well, that's how the mobile home rents are, the rent control, isn't it?
No, I think they're limited to the CPI, but for which, 6/10 of the CPI. But which one do they use? My guess is they'd have to use one in L.A. or...
I think it's Los Angeles.
In other words, it's sort of a legal question. Where would I go get that number if I was a tenant?
On the web, on the Internet, you can look up those statistics for an area that would encompass our county.
And for the mobile home rent control ordinance adjustments, isn't it the CPI for Los Angeles?
I'm not sure.
The city of San Luis used to be, and I'm just...
Probably.
Maybe if some member of the public knows, they can help us out. Maybe Warren could look that up while he's...
Okay. Can we, may we continue? All right, staff, did you have more? Or?
Only if I could try to summarize some of the concerns I've heard at the commission here.
In the other ordinances, which say there shall not be a loss of affordable units, does that mean that there shall be no loss of deed-restricted affordable units, or that there shall be no loss of affordability more widely defined?
In other jurisdictions, they use the broader definition that there will be no loss of units that are affordable or occupied by low and moderate income.
Certain specified income level families.
That's correct.
So would that then allow the conversion of an apartment to a condominium if that apartment were occupied by higher income individuals?
In those other jurisdictions, yes. And if any one of the units is occupied by a lower income individual, then the developer needs to show the replacement unit. Is he going to provide a unit on site or off site to replace the loss, to ensure that there's no loss of affordable units?
Or they could simply let all the units go vacant and then there's no loss of affordable units if no one's living there.
And I wouldn't accept that, because if the rent used to be X, you know, now that there no one has lived in it for 2 years, I would assume that the rent would still be that or slightly more. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that which gets into kind of a gray area, how you're going to make that finding. But are we going to hear from the public on this?
Yes.
And
mm-hmm.
finish this one up and then do mobile homes, or are we going to do them all together? Well, how is the chair going on this?
Well, and staff, how do you have a recommendation?
I actually would suggest allowing the public to speak at this moment just on condominium conversions.
Okay.
I would agree.
Yeah, we can dust this one off.
Yeah, otherwise we'll be all over the map.
Otherwise we'll get confused.
Okay, I'll try and go through. Are we ready for public?
Yeah. Well, but you need to know if they're what they're talking on.
That's what I say. I'm going to try and do that. Well, the first two say park conversion. Park conversion. Request for county to amend Title 22.
Maybe you could just ask for a show of hands who wants to speak to condo conversion.
Okay, maybe that's... That might be the best way. Anyone want to speak to the condo conversion?
And we'll do the mobile home stuff later.
Okay. Mr. John Wallace? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission. Just a brief question about this proposal. I also wanted to speak primarily in the mobile home stuff, but just a question to clarify on this. Under the situation where you were looking at limiting the number of conversions to 50% of the rental units built in the previous year, if you had no apartments built in the previous year, do you go back to the year before that? And if there were none built there, do you go back to the year before that? Or are you, in essence, saying that if there's no rental units built, do you go into a moratorium on conversions until there are some rental units built? And how would you account for that? Is it like our allocation on growth management? So that's a question, just for clarification.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else on condos? All right, that looks like it. Everyone else wants to talk about the park, so I'll bring it back to the commission.
Maybe staff could answer that.
Yes,
Walter's question.
Oh. And he's leaving. Oh, okay.
Because I don't have a printer and I can't take what I have over to him.
Well, maybe staff could answer the other question.
Yeah.
I know you guys know.
Yes, if I may. The way that this draft ordinance is written, it does not allow carryover from previous years, only from one prior year. In other words, we're looking at the number of units that were built in the prior calendar year would determine how many units could be converted in the current year. That's an interesting concept to have a carryover maybe going back 2 or 3 years, but the existing draft ordinance doesn't have that. As to the regard to the impact of the growth management ordinance, I don't pretend to be an expert there, but we're not creating new units. We have the same number of residential units. We're changing the ownership of the units. So I don't know if the growth management ordinance has any thing that would prohibit the change of ownership.
I think what perhaps was being asked was, would the stipulations in the growth management ordinance affect new rental housing being built?
And my answer to that would be, thank you for that clarification.
You might have a condo conversion project ready to go that does provide housing stock at a different level than detached housing, which is not exactly affordable, but not high-priced either from that standpoint. So,
no, understanding the question,
you're forcing yourself out of that market.
No, we weren't proposing that.
And for the 50%, tagging this to 50% of the apartment units built in the previous year, would that be the units built throughout the unincorporated area?
That's correct.
So, you know, Los Osos could get credit for an apartment in Napomo.
That's correct.
I guess in assessing whether to, you know, how to judge the number of condo conversions that are allowed, I'd like to go back to a couple hopefully clear statements of policy within our housing element. And I apologize for not knowing this off the top of my head, but in terms of this ordinance, I think the first thing this ordinance needs is a clear statement of its intent. I think that was the gist of what we came with this first flurry of questions on. And, you know, I'm headed toward the idea that we need a continuance, hopefully not too long, to get that clear statement of intent. And that statement of intent has to, in my mind, come from policies that should be in our housing element. And so my first question is, what does the housing element specifically say about unrestricted rental stock? Does it say our policy is to maintain it, or does it say that our policy is to increase it? How do we? This is board adopted policy in the housing element.
Well, and while you're looking up that specific question, Mr. Lilly, I'm lamenting the fact I didn't bring my housing element with me today. But my recollection of it, I've read it a few times, is that there are a whole host of policies in there that you could basically pick and choose from in terms of being the guiding policy statements for this document. And so I don't know what Mr. Lilly's answer is going to be relative to out-and-out rental units, but if it's the Commission's desire to have this ordinance reflect a policy of, you know, protecting, maintaining, and enhancing affordable housing, I'm confident that the policies are in the element.
And I was going to get to that.
Okay.
Because I think there's a couple things at play here. One is the assumption that rental stock, by its nature, is relatively affordable because it's more tied to market forces. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's the ideal. If the market can deliver affordable housing, rental housing in this instance, I think that's great. We know that the market can't provide all the affordable housing that we want, so we're contemplating things like inclusionary housing, and we're contemplating things like limits on the conversion of condos. But just to start, in terms of trying to craft clear intent language for this ordinance, that's why I asked the question about simply, is there a policy that speaks to the amount of rental stock?
Okay, I'll attempt to answer that. There isn't a specific policy that very specifically addresses maintaining rental housing stock, but Commissioner Christie is also correct that there are a variety of policies in the housing element that you could reference if you so wished. For example, one policy number 7 on page 4.2 of the housing element says the county will continue to plan for future housing needs beyond the state required planning period. The next policy is the county will promote housing opportunities and talks about regardless of race, sex, marital status, etc. I mean, those could be construed to mean we need to plan for housing needs. Rental housing is part of it. Therefore, this ordinance follows.
Right. And so, I think that in general, you're on the right track by limiting condo conversions to an amount of an amount of rental housing built so that we're not losing rental housing. We certainly don't want to do that. It seems to me that in the current affordability situation, we want to encourage rental housing, a difficult proposition, I understand, for, you know, reasons beyond the county's control. But, you know, in crafting a revision to this ordinance, which may be where we're headed, I'll leave it to other commissioners to offer their thoughts on it. I think probably elsewhere in our general plan you'll find policies regarding the need for rental housing stock. And so I think that basically you were in the right ballpark by suggesting that condo conversions should be limited to half of rental housing built. I don't see a public policy objective that's served by doing a carryover to previous years. I mean, it would seem that we're trying to encourage the unrestricted stock of affordable housing is one thing here. So, I don't know if my fellow commissioners had any thoughts on that.
Well, I agree with essentially everything you said. I probably would favor outright prohibition, restricted for affordability is really the you know, the straightforward, common sense, enforceable way to add to our affordable housing stock in this county. And so that would be the approach that I would favor.
See, Mr. Hogue has just got something.
I don't have anything further on this vein of the conversation, but there was a question earlier about what is the measure used for determining the CPI increase for mobile home rent control. And it's established in the Mobile Home Rent Control Ordinance, and I'll just read it to you, if I may. It's the maximum monthly space rent may be increased by no more than once a year by an increase over the then-existing space rent equal to 60% of the cost of living increase. And then that's, in parentheses, all urban consumers, Los Angeles, Long Beach, Anaheim area, as furnished by the Division of Labor Statistics and Research, State of California Department of Industrial Relations, in parentheses, for the preceding 12-month period.
Okay. And I would suggest that we would use the same.
Unless
staff finds a more recent one, and I don't think there is one for that.
A more specific to the county one.
Yeah.
It looks to me like we're almost there, but we're not quite.
Yeah. I've got one.
So I would suggest that we need to continue this to, one, get the statement of intent that Mr. Gibson was talking about to clean up the CPI thing, and that we add, as part of the report, an analysis of the effect of this conversion on the affordable housing stock.
Yeah.
And then I have another question, maybe you already know the answer. Has this... These proposed restrictions, have they been implemented anywhere else? And if so, what was the effect on that? Did that increase, decrease the apartment building? Did it, you know, as Commissioner Christie said, let's not do any harm. So maybe this is going to cease all apartment building forever? Or
I'll answer that. The other jurisdictions that have, I would say the ones that have a restriction that there be no condo conversions if there's a vacancy level of 5% or less, that pretty much stops any conversion of condos, but it wouldn't stop the development of new rental units. What we're proposing is that the number of conversions be tied to the number of rental units that were built. And as you've seen in the staff report, we typically get bubbles or large apartment projects that are built at one time, and then we don't get anything for another couple years. I don't think that's going to change because of this condo conversion ordinance, but I think it will make the community at large more aware of when apartments are built, because then those who want to convert their condos will be coming in the next year. I mean, convert their apartments will be coming in the next year to apply for condo conversions. I could go into more details, but I think that's that would stop. I'll stop right there.
What I've heard you say is you're not expecting, but I didn't hear any data that the city of Atascadero has seen an increase or decrease in construction, or Ventura did this and something happened or didn't happen.
I can't imagine that this ordinance in and of itself changes the incentive to build rental stock, multifamily rental stock, as we traditionally think of it. There are problems in getting, you know, as we've heard many times here, getting common wall multifamily rental, or getting common wall multifamily structures built that would normally be the bread and butter of the rental stock here. I think we should be doing separate from any of this consideration. We certainly should be looking at incentives to increase the likelihood that new rental stock gets built, just as in the next segment we should be increasing the incentives to see new mobile home parks or manufactured home parks get built. But I think this, I don't see a connection that causes less rental housing to be built because of anything we choose to do about its conversion or not to ownership, condo ownership. And I had one other policy that I wanted to explore as regards the intent. I don't know, but I'd be happy to yield to other commissioners first.
You're done? I just have one other question. It actually relates to the last statement. I think it was the last statement you made, and then the information that's in our staff report, which talks about the county of San Luis Obispo, and over the past 3 years, that we had a 20-unit.
04, there were 134. But it goes into 06, then they lose that. I agree. We need to have some spelled out multiple year time period or something.
Well, if we are headed toward a continuous, maybe staff could bring us back some options on that. Yeah. Again, under the presumptive policy goal that we are to be encouraging rental housing to increase.
I agree.
Well, I think it's under the goal that we're going to be encouraging affordable housing. And yes, rental housing certainly is, I would assume, I don't know, more affordable.
More.
But also, on a spectrum of the real estate market, condominiums are generally much more affordable and on the lower end than...
Yeah. And the opportunity, and I think there is a benefit to encouraging home ownership at the segment the investment of you know, both financial and emotional in owning one's own home is an important public policy. It has to be balanced against our other goals, and that was the other general policy area that I wanted to ask staff to come back to us with. Again, speaking to the intent of this ordinance, You had indicated that it comes from a desire to at least protect, if not encourage, affordable housing. I mean, our housing element, again, been a while since I read it, but I would trust Commissioner Christie to know that there are goals in there for increasing affordability in the county in terms of affordable housing. And as such, I think that should be, if this ordinance, which it seems to me it does, comes forward under an effort to achieve that goal, that should be part of its intent. And then I think we could use some analysis of those other ordinances elsewhere in the state which require some preservation of affordability. In essence, the condo conversion would have an inclusionary component to it, and we could adjust the parameters of that to meet the specific goals that we're trying to get to. But I think it's appropriate that this coming forward as a means of protecting affordability should have some kind of inclusionary. And that's why I was asking about the impact report, because it seems to me that that's the ideal vehicle for understanding what the affordability of the rental units are before their conversion, and that we then should craft this ordinance to make some attempt, whether it's 1-to-1 or some other ratio, of protecting that affordability.
So, Commissioner Gibson, if I'm following you correctly, I'm assuming that when you say these should include an inclusionary component, that you're talking about deed restricting at least some of the units. I mean, that's typically how
I think that's something we should
inclusionary.
Consider.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's something we should consider.
Okay,
I mean,
we are
coming forward with an inclusionary housing ordinance for new construction.
Right.
It seems consistent to me that there should be some analogous provision in this ordinance that creates real affordable housing. Now, whether it's 1-to-1 or some other ratio, I'm up for that discussion, because I think there are competing goals that we want to balance. We have the property owner's desire to make a profit on the ownership of property. I think that can't be dismissed out of hand. We have the goal of increasing home ownership, which has its own public benefit, and we have the goal of protecting affordable housing and encouraging affordable housing. So as to the numbers, I'm not at a point of saying where I'd come down on that, but I think that would be a subject of good discussion for us next time around.
And the point that I want to underscore here is that while, you know, it's correct that condominiums are cheaper than single-family homes, and therefore they're affordable to a segment of the population that couldn't buy houses otherwise, as Commissioner Rappa pointed out, they're not necessarily affordable to the people who are living in them as apartments. And so they're, you know, under the current scenario, there would absolutely be displacement going on. So I'd like to make another suggestion for staff to bring back in the revised ordinance. And I think, as I mentioned last time, 2 months' worth of rental assistance basically just pays their first and last month's rent. And isn't rental assistance in the idea of being able to help them get on their feet in their new location? They may have had to move out of the area. They may need to find a new job. So I think we need to consider providing more than 2 months' rental assistance if we are going to go ahead with the idea of allowing conversions, which I'm getting the strong sense that we are.
All right. Do we want to make a motion on this at this time for this
Mr. part Chairman?
Go ahead.
You've applied for it, but where it isn't required, that there's no need to do that.
Just for a clarification, though, we're required to do it beyond a certain number, but we're not prohibited from doing it under a certain
number.
That's
true. It's voluntary. It does add to the cost, of course, to a conversion to submit a report to the Department of Real Estate where one's not required. And I'm not certain what the Department of Real Estate will do with the report when they get one where it's not required, but assuming that they know what to do with it, we could continue to require it. I just don't know whether it's worth it or not.
So the report goes to the Department of Real Estate, and it does not. What about going to the tenants who are?
Well, the way it works,
they would automatically be noticed, correct?
This requires that when you submit your application for the report to the Department of Real Estate, you tell the tenants, by the way, I've sought a report from the Department of Real Estate. As I understand it, that report is then used by potential buyers to look at the Department of Real Estate's analysis of the condo conversion project.
Can you give us an idea of what the benefit is to the tenant of that? Is there must be some benefit conveyed, or there wouldn't be a law about it.
If the potential purchaser, then the tenant would know that the report would be forthcoming and could obtain it and make an assessment as to whether or not it's worth trying to buy the unit.
Okay, so that benefit may well be conveyed to people who happen to be living in a unit that's below the threshold number.
But isn't there a right to purchase in our ordinance at this point? So I mean,
maybe,
they'll
maybe
know.
We're kind of guessing. Maybe this is something staff could look into
and
come back
exactly.
to us on.
Okay.
Do we want to take action then on this portion of it?
I move to continue this item. Are we going to go off calendar, staff, or do you have a
Actually,
date to bring us back?
We have reserved time on your July 13th agenda for this package. So you could continue to July 13th. It sounds like what you've asked us for is doable within that short time frame.
And you took enough notes, or do you need us to reiterate what we want?
Not reiterate, please.
I'm moved to continue.
To July 13th.
I think
July
we have 13th. Enough notes.
Is there a second to that?
Yes.
All right, so moved and second. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, so carried. Okay.
Thank you, and with that, I will continue the presentation, this time to talk about the proposed mobile home park conversion ordinance. And first up, why is the county considering this ordinance? to back up a little bit, this issue came up as the staff was updating the housing element. In all of our housing element workshops, the issue was raised many times about there being a lack of a mobile home park conversion ordinance. So consequently, the county adopted a revised housing element that requires the county to consider a mobile home park conversion ordinance. It's now mandated in our general plan, so we are now carrying this forward to you today. Some of the recent activities we've done to carry out this mandate would be back in October of 2005, we held a public workshop and issued a concept paper addressing a mobile home park conversion ordinance and what the key components should be. We had a study session before your commission on April 27th. And since that time, we've had four subsequent meetings with both mobile home park owners and mobile home park residents to go over the draft ordinance and address issues and concerns of those groups. What we learned from these recent activities was that mobile home parks are lost incrementally. You don't see a mobile home park lost overnight. Typically, park owners or developers will buy up units in the park as they come on, come into the market for sale. And eventually, then the park owner, when they own most or all of the units, they are simply renting them out. So it's like an apartment. Anytime you like, you can close your park and just give everyone, all your renters, a 30-day notice. We also learned that the financial impact to the park owners is not easy to pin down. Some of the things we would need to know are how many units do the park owners already own, because these units could be removed any time. Again, if a park owner would not be obligated to pay relocation costs or to buy a unit if, in fact, he already owns the unit and he's simply renting it. Then, as far as rent control goes, how many people are still enjoying the benefits of rent control today? Is it the number steady? Is it increasing? Is it declining? We've heard that it could be declining over time. And so that would, if that's learned that there has been more information that will be presented to you by the residents themselves as to the makeup of their park. So I don't want to steal their thunder, but basically they found that with the earlier information I had, that a majority that they provided me, a majority of the residents are retired and on fixed income. In the Sea Oaks Mobile Home Park, a large park of 125 spaces, that is also it is a senior park, and a majority of the residents tell me that they are low or very low-income residents. This is not unusual considering what we're seeing as far as the findings and policies across jurisdictions across the state. They basically say that the reason for considering a mobile home park conversion ordinance is that mobile home parks are a source of attractive, affordable housing, and some jurisdictions have gone ahead and taken steps to protect that as a resource, a housing resource. What staff does know is that, again, through the research that we've conducted, we know the cost of relocating units, replacement value of units, and how in-place values are determined, how in-place value appraisals are done. It appears that approximately 20% to 30% of the mobile home units in mobile home parks are pre-76 mobile home. We have talked to staff in other jurisdictions about mobile home park conversions and subdivisions that have been done elsewhere. And our response to this research is we, as in your staff report, we are making four proposed changes to our earlier draft ordinance. The first one is that we're adding a definition of a permanent resident. Again, the intent of the ordinance as staff prepared it is not to help part-time residents or vacation residents, but to help permanent residents of a mobile home park. State law is silent on that. They say that relocation costs should be provided to all residents of a mobile home park, but what staff is suggesting is that the benefits that we're suggesting should be reserved only for permanent residents of a mobile home park. And the definition of permanent, we're suggesting a change to what you've seen in your draft pack, your package of your draft ordinance. On page 3-25 and 3-31, we would like to shorten up the definition of a permanent resident. And as the change is what you see on the screen. Down at the bottom, say page 3-25, for example, what staff would suggest is adding a sentence that says permanent resident status is established at the time the mobile home park conversion application is submitted. Then go on, just like you see on the staff report, a permanent residence is anyone who lives in the mobile home park for 270 days or more in a 12-month period, and stop right there. We would strike out the rest of that subsection. It dealt with one other way that someone could prove that they're a permanent resident by submitting various documents of that show that their address is in a mobile home park. But basically, as long as the person lives in a mobile home park for 270 days, they should be considered a permanent residence. And you can find that out by looking at utility bills, rental bills, or rental checks, and other documents like that. So that's the first change that we're recommending. Second change that we're recommending from the draft that your commission had seen earlier is that we limit who should be able to receive in-place value for their unit. The argument was made that since this is an affordable housing ordinance, if a mobile home park or a mobile home residence is a wealthy resident, we're not following out our county policies if we are helping wealthy residents to get in-place value for their units. So the rest of this, throughout the state, other jurisdictions don't make this distinction. They simply say that if a space cannot be found in a mobile home park, then the developer shall buy the unit. If he's intending to convert it, then he needs to submit an application to do so and be talking to the residents as to relocation benefits. The last change that the staff is proposing is that mobile home park subdivisions should be prohibited. As was pointed out to us, the state law preempts the county's ability to add requirements to a mobile home park subdivision. The state law simply says that the residents in a subdivision of a mobile home park, the residents should be given the option to buy their space or to have a 4-year rental agreement. That's it. The county cannot do anything more than that. The county cannot require relocation benefits. Now, the problem is that because of the high cost of real estate in our county, it's not likely that many residents will be able to buy the space that their unit is on. So therefore, one option is just to prohibit mobile home park subdivisions altogether. This is actually what has Santa Barbara County has done, and it has not been challenged, to my knowledge, that particular restriction. This restriction would still allow residents to buy their mobile home park and own it as a group and to sell shares of ownership in the mobile home park. That's how a handful of parks in our county are already set up. QMAS Village and a couple more
the residents got together, bought the mobile home park, and now they own and sell shares in their park. Not, they don't own the space, they own a share of the park. So one of the change to the text that's in your package is, you can see on the screen, I made a slight word change to the mobile home park subdivision ordinance or provision. As you see on the screen, I would change the wording to say conversion of an existing mobile home park from a rental mobile home park to a mobile home subdivision with ownership of individual lots or to a condominium ownership is prohibited. My earlier version had a term in it called residential ownership, which, if you look in state law, it's used in several different places, either under the subdivision when you're subdividing a mobile home park, or when the state provides funding to help residents buy their park, you find that term residential ownership. So to minimize the confusion, I removed that term entirely and would suggest the language that you see on your screen. Again, to summarize what other jurisdictions have, not all of them have mobile home park ordinances. The ones that do, the ordinance emphasizes compensation to the displaced residents. Santa Barbara County happens to prohibit mobile home park subdivisions. This county could consider compensation only for permanent residents, not for renters or who don't own their home or their unit, or to vacation home. This county could also consider allowing relocation to sites outside of a mobile home park, a site of the unit's owners, a site that is acceptable to the owner of the unit. The county paid for a study in 1990 that was carried out by People's Self-Help Housing, and that study identified 42 mobile home parks at the time and considered 13 of those parks to be at risk. Three of them have closed in the last 15 years. Today, we have 39 mobile home parks with a total of 2,646 spaces. Now, the parks that some of these parks may still be at risk, and that is due to either incorrect zoning, if it's on a multifamily zone, the park owners buying up the units, or just poor management of the park. So what the proposed ordinance in front of you does is if someone wants to convert a mobile home park, it would require that a conditional use permit application be submitted, that along with that, an impact report be submitted that describes the number of households that would be displaced, their age and income level, the condition of the mobile home to be displaced, are there spaces available in other mobile home parks, and what would the cost of moving that mobile home be? The draft ordinance recommends financial compensation to displaced residents, that the developer income house person or household, if that one person does not earn more than $71,000 a year, then they're considered a workforce income person. And again, the draft ordinance as it's been revised from our previous study session, as a result of all the meetings that we've had, staff and the research, staff recommended that mobile home park subdivisions be prohibited. We have a special finding in the ordinance, in the draft ordinance, that the decision maker or the county must find that adequate measures were taken to address the adverse impact of displaced residents before they approved closing a mobile home park. And in summary, if I may, what this draft mobile home park ordinance is, you could say that it's a what-if ordinance. What if mobile home parks close? What would the requirements be? It would provide financial compensation for displaced mobile homeowners. It would not stop park owners from buying the units or incremental closing of the mobile home park. It would not ensure continuous rent control. the draft ordinance, as you see it, would prohibit mobile home park subdivision, but residents could still buy their park. And that concludes the presentation, so I'd be happy to answer your question.
Any questions?
A quick question, Mr. Bench. In talking about the prohibition on subdivision, you said it's prohibited subdivisions that would have ownership of individual lots or condominium ownership, and I was curious about the difference between those two concepts.
They're the same. You could strike condominium conversion if you wanted from that text.
I'm going to save my questions and comments till after the public.
Okay. Any questions, Bob? No?
I did have one question. We were given some notes concerning various San Francisco County ordinance change, Planning Commission hearing, 22 July, and I have no idea who's this from. Okay. Now I know.
It was presented to staff before the meeting, and so now it's part of a presentation from one of the members of the audience, so now it's available to you.
Okay.
All right.
I had one observation here, and that was on your analysis on page 3-6 about you were talking about appraisals, and I just got to ask if these facts are anywhere close to being true. Why isn't the county's trying to get more affordable housing? Why aren't we zoning and encouraging more mobile home parks?
I'll take a stab at that. Again, Dana Lilly. We do intend to bring ordinances forward in the future to promote more mobile home parks. This ordinance package here is just looking at what to do when owners propose closing or converting them. We allow fairly high density as single family neighborhoods go for mobile home parks, and some of the potential developers have told us you need to allow even higher densities, which would be multifamily densities, for mobile home parks to happen. And so we'll be looking at that as a possibility. They have two-story manufactured housing units now, and it may make sense for the county to consider allowing space rental housing in that form in a higher density than we currently allow.
Would this proposed ordinance, which precludes converting, subdividing one, would it preclude building one from scratch?
No.
Okay.
In fact, somebody could subdivide a piece of land and sell the units, sell the lots as mobile home spaces. That would not be precluded. This would address existing mobile home parks.
That would not be? I didn't understand what you said.
I'm sorry. Someone could build a new mobile home park. They could even build a new mobile home park subdivision. This ordinance only applies to existing mobile home parks, closing an existing mobile home park.
Mm. And if one wanted to do that now, he'd have to go find some probably residential multifamily zone land. Am I correct?
Or single family.
But then you got 6,000 square foot lots, which are...
Actually, I believe in the single family, we allow mobile home parks at 8 units an acre, whereas making lots for home ownership, you have your 6,000 square foot lots requirement and higher in some communities. So in essence, you could say we allow mobile home parks at a higher density than we would allow more conventional development, and yet we're still not seeing them.
And anybody know why not?
That's improper zoning, because in a multifamily zone, you could take the mobile home park out and put higher density development. In a commercial zone, you'd take the mobile home park out and put in commercial development.
Oh, I know what it means. I was just curious of the number.
Oh, how many that? I don't know.
Okay.
Is that it? Is that it on questions?
For now, yeah.
I've got a bunch of speakers. So you want to break now or wait, or what do you want to do on a break?
What time is it?
It's 7 minutes to 3.
How much public testimony do you think?
We got at least a dozen.
I think we make our escape now and come back.
That's fine with me.
Is that agreeable?
That's fine.
Yep.
All right, then let's
We'll be back at 10 after 3 to reconvene. We'll take our break now.